Hi, I'm Bart Kazivian, special counsel to the FCIC. And this is Scott Gans, special assistant to the vice chairman, Bill Thomas. What's the date today?
The 11th.
It's March 11th, a little after 9 a.m. We're at the OCC headquarters, and we're here to interview Ron Frake, who's the national bank examiner in the large bank supervision group.
Senior National Bank Examiner in the Large Bank Supervision Group.
Okay.
Yes.
Can we have the other attendees identify themselves for the...
Linda Bridgman, Assistant Director of Enforcement and Compliance for the OCC.
Alyssa Sagri, Attorney in Enforcement and Compliance.
So I'm supposed to tell you the commission was established by statute, signed into law by the President. There are 10 commissioners. The Bipartisan Commission is charged with examining the cause of the financial crisis. The Commission is to provide a report to the President of the United States and Congress by December 15, 2010, containing the findings and conclusions of the Commission. The Commission may require by subpoena or otherwise the attendance and testimony of witnesses, the production of books, records, correspondence, memorandum, paper, and documents. If you have any questions, we can provide a copy of the statute. And as your folks know, I'm supposed to remind you about Title 18, Section 1001, the same section that governs your folks when you're out talking to the banks about the criminal penalties for misleading federal officials. Mm-hmm. Same thing covers us. So generally, if I ask a question you don't understand, let me know. I don't regard this as a deposition or an adversarial proceeding, and so if I ask a question, answer it, but if you think there's a better question, let me know. And this is basically an educational experience for us because you've lived in this world, and, and we're just dipping our toes in, and we know that. So my guess is it'll take us like 4 or 5 hours. If you need a break, if we want to stop for lunch, you know, whatever you guys want to do, we're fine with. Just let us know. Is there anything else on here? Anything else I'm supposed to say, Scott?
No, I think we're good to go.
Okay.
Not that I would know much better than you.
So I'll start with sort of my basic broad overview, and then we'll dive into the documents, all of which we've obtained from the OCC, except one document that we got from the Fed in New York that was copied to Scott Waterhouse. It's not clear to me that you've seen all these documents,
no.
Or even if you have seen them, that you would remember them. I mean, I know I can't remember stuff from 5 years ago. So I'm just using it to refresh your recollection.
Okay.
To help me understand what you were thinking and what the OCC was thinking at the time. And just for your information, the reason I picked you is because there was a memo.
Picked a better
job. I don't know.
There was a memo you
cooperative person.
You signed back in 2005 where it looked to me like you were one of the first people to get a whiff of what was going on in the failure of the bank to have adequate risk management systems, in particular with respect to the CDOs that eventually blew up.
The credit derivatives.
Right.
Yep.
And so that's sort of the start of the story. I've got some documents that predate that just because when we were going through, you know, I saw something that I thought was of interest, and so I pulled those. But for me, the basic arc of the story is from 2005 when you and your group first sort of said, hey, what the heck's going on here, through to 2008 when the downgrade hits and on the exam rating and then later the C&D or MOU. So without any further clearing of my throat, we'll just dive in.
There's just, I think, a point that's very important for you to know.
Sure.
And that is, you know, when we go out and perform these examinations, all right, people at my level aren't usually the assigned examiner in charge.
Right.
We've selected someone on our team, all right, to be an examiner in charge of that particular examination. So I just want you to know that I sit, you know, as a team leader. My official responsibility is a team leader for capital markets. Now that covers, you know, the trading area of the bank as well as the treasury area of the bank.
Right.
Right? We have, you know, a team of people, and basically in each one of these examinations, and I pulled off the ones in your request that really are germane to me, in each one of these situations, I sat on the top, reviewed the material,
right,
and basically saw that the letter was, you know, in my view, appropriate, and then sent it off to the examiner in charge for their review as well.
Definitely.
So I just think, so as you're going through things, yes, I did not, before this meeting, go through all the work papers for these exams. Didn't have time. No, you guys have a very quick, you know, time frame to get around. But my only point is that if there's a highly technical question,
ask someone else.
Well, yes, or if you'd like, you can either ask someone else, or I can go back and get the answers to you and bring them back to you, however you feel it appropriate to pursue and get the most efficient, all right, response.
Fair enough.
So I just wanted you to know that. And I do, you know, have each one of these supervisory letters, and I also have, and these were provided to you, copies of the reports of exam that we issued on Citibank NA for those years, specifically related to what we call price risk. And that's basically the front office risk exposures relating to trading activities. All right, so again, I thought they were relevant. I am fully prepared to talk off, you know, each one of these and hopefully give you a better understanding of the story, what we're finding, and what we're trying to do.
Okay.
But
so, how long have you been with the OCC?
Over 30 years.
And how long have you been in the large bank supervision group, roughly?
Roughly, I would say about 15 years.
And has that been principally in New York, or have
Yes. Actually, my career has been in New York in a variety of capacities, but I've been in New York the whole time.
And how long have you been on the Citibank? Do they rotate you in and out?
Yes, they rotate us. I was brought into Citibank in 1999, all right? But when I was brought in under supervising different responsibilities than what I have now.
Right.
So there was a bit of a reshuffle. So way back then, I had like audit and transaction services businesses and asset management.
Gotcha.
And so in February of 2003 or thereabouts, I was moved into the team leader position of capital markets and have been there since that time.
Okay.
A very interesting time.
A good window on the world.
I don't know about good. An interesting window on the world, right?
That's right. All right, well, let's dive into the documents.
Gotcha.
The first one I pulled for two reasons. One is it's one of these things from the Capital Markets Approval Committee, which I understand was sort of their new products committee. This is a draft dated December 13th, 2002, and it's titled Coventry Capital Liquidity Put Option.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason I pulled it was the first thing I saw that said liquidity put option.
Right.
And as we both know, that's going to be part of the story as we get further down the road. Now, I don't know if this was the first liquidity put option, and it certainly wasn't a... It appears to have been a commercial credit backed and not a mortgage backed. Transaction. But I wanted to just sort of, and this apparently predates your role as a team leader of capital markets. So why don't you just tell me about the first time you heard about either a liquidity put, or I guess sometimes they used total return swaps as some sort of backup facility?
They're separate and distinct concepts.
Okay.
I had not seen this document, all right, but in my discussions, I was aware that, you know, some of, at least one of our examiners from the Risk Analysis Division, and it may be useful to just spend a minute,
sure,
all right, and explain to you the functioning of our Risk Analysis Division.
Sure.
When we go in and perform exams, given the extremely complex and technical nature of these businesses, as well as the modeling, all right, and obviously the functioning of models behind these businesses.
We've seen the books.
I'm sure you have. We, OCC, went out and basically built a team of quantitative experts that basically one of their primary roles is to support, all right, the OCC in looking at, you know, sophisticated models and or applications of those models and giving us feedback and input, all right, as far as whether they believe that those models are, you know, doing what they should or not, or at least interacting with the quantitative resources in the banks, all right? So I was aware that one of our people from RAD had been involved or had looked at this Coventry, all right, liquidity put. But again, that's all I know. And if you want more specific on, you know, what exactly was looked at Coventry, my guess is you're probably right. This may not be, you know, a mortgage document. But the only thing is there, and to specifically respond to your question, the knowledge of liquidity puts, we did have information on liquidity puts. I think it was probably early in 2003, right, where the bank, and again, this might have even predated that, but again, there was some discussion early in 2003 as far as a liquidity put.
Now, I think his question to you is to just give him
yes,
your understanding of what, how they worked. Is that your question?
Yeah,
well, I mean, how they came about, right?
Right.
All right, the fundamental, right, the liquidity put structure was intended to basically not be credit support for an underlying off-balance sheet special purpose vehicle structure. It was intended to provide coverage if there was some dislocation in the commercial paper market. So really, a liquidity put was intended to, for a short period of time, if there was a dislocation for some reason in the functioning of the commercial paper market, the liquidity put was there as a backstop for the financial institution that issued it to step in and fund the vehicle in some manner, right, either through commercial paper or if the put was exercised in the form of longer-term, medium-term notes.
Right.
For a period of time until that dislocation stopped. Now, it's my understanding and what I've been told that to that point, there really had not been, all right, in recent history, any dislocations in the commercial paper market. And so if you think of this in an option term, and that's what it was, a put option, it was about as far out of the money as you could get. And the chance of exercise of you stepping in and having to fund it was extremely remote. Now, again, going back in history, my understanding of the liquidity puts was that it was only covering the super senior position of a particular structured investment vehicle. Now,
that now, are we talking the CDOs to the
correct
that were sold to the SPEs managed by the Wall Street firm?
That is correct.
Okay.
Talking about those very vehicles that Citi ultimately stepped in and funded. But the really that particular instrument was only there in the event of a CP dislocation, CP market dislocation, which clearly happened. But no one foresaw the fact that the whole CP market for these vehicles would basically stop and not come back. The view was this liquidity put would only cover a very short, you know, dislocated market, and that the market would go back to functioning, and then the bank would step out, and the normal commercial paper investors would come back in.
So, in essence, it's sort of like a bridge loan on a construction project that's supposed to get you started, and there's supposed to be a permanent takeout loan, but if there's, if the project falls apart and there's...
No, because that bridge loan fundamentally, all right, is there and has credit risk associated with it. Once you cross over from a pure liquidity dislocation, in other words, there's something that happens in a market,
right,
that for a very short period of time destabilizes it, and the original investors in CP don't want to invest in it, that's when these will step in, fund the commercial paper. The understanding was it was just a liquidity facility, not a credit backstop. The bridge loan thought, and you know, you're making an analogy, right, but it's not a right one, because okay, in this particular instrument, there was no legal credit risk being assumed. Now what happened at the end of the day is the bank stepped in and basically assumed the credit risk and took these things on balance sheet.
So you're saying that they were not legally required to
do this? That is my understanding. But they did, because my understanding, the investors behind this commercial paper were very significant investors, very significant clients of the bank. And effectively, if you follow the flow, and we'll get to that in a minute, some of the assets feeding into those special purpose vehicles were basically coming through Citigroup in some point.
Right.
So, you know, it's hard to argue when these large-scale commercial paper investors, who basically are large fund names,
right,
large mutual fund names, right, when they come in and say, you know, yeah, wait a minute, if you, and again, I don't know the substance of these conversations, but what I, you know, understand is that those commercial paper investors had discussions with management, and basically management made the decision to accept the risk, take these on balance sheet, and assume the credit risk that legally, per the liquidity put, they were not, right, supposed to have taken or assumed in those structures. So again, the importance of these liquidity puts is it was covering the super senior piece,
right,
of these instruments. So if you understand the basics of securitization,
right,
you take a huge pool of assets,
right,
and you carve out, you basically create tranches. And if I'm going through stuff that you already understand, please let me know, and I'll back off the...
It's okay. Good to have it for the record.
Gotcha. They set up tranches as far as who will assume the first level of losses,
right,
in that structure.
Right.
So you have an equity piece, and then you have mezzanine, usually a piece or, you know, a laddered set of pieces. Then you have a senior piece, which is basically, you know, highly rated. And then above that is what's called the super senior exposure. In other words,
right,
the best possible quality, you know, the structure, and I might add, the rating agency's view when they rate this particular credit is that losses should in no way, shape, or form go through all those subordinate tranches and layers and hit that super senior piece. So the commercial paper investors were basically funding the super senior exposures.
Right.
And so the view was the liquidity put was, you know, a very low cost, all right, basically for the structure to pay to the bank to support in a transaction that effectively should never really have that the, have been funded.
And the fee was roughly 10 to 15 basis points.
That is correct. That's my understanding as well. All right, so again, that's the substance behind the liquidity put.
And your understanding of the sort of the legal obligations of the liquidity put, you obtained that from people at Citi who explained it to you, or from?
I would say people at Citi who've explained it to us, and also some of our folks that may have looked at some of the documentation underlying it.
Okay.
All right. So I think the important component there is, as far as the, and here's one of the issues that gets back to the whole, you know, financial crisis, if you will. You know, the view of securitizations. Right? And I think the view was that effectively credit risk was being disintermediated, right?
Right.
Out to a varied pool of investors, whether they be, you know, hedge funds that basically would step in and pick up equity pieces of these instruments, or banks or insurance companies that basically would come in and look at the mezzanine pieces and commercial paper investors. So it appeared that the credit risk exposure that in prior crises, and, you know, I've sat through a variety of prior crises, and, you know, in the 80s and early 90s, you know, it seemed like with commercial real estate anyway, and I'm sure you had some exposure in the Northeast at that time, because I did as well, but it appeared that there was no ultimate contagion, because in that crisis, the exposure was confined mostly to the banks. Here, in this crisis, as I sat in my chair and looked back at this, it appeared over years that credit risk was being disintermediated to parties. But at the end of the day, it circled back and came back in through contingent liabilities, call them liquidity puts, call them whatever you might call them. But when large clients basically came knocking on the door, these exposures came back, and it was not expected.
Right.
And so, but I think at the end of the day, and I mean the whole issue of rating agencies, and, you know, is a topic maybe for a different day, but the banks took these exposures back, most likely because of their relationships with these clients. But also, I think probably because of some of the ramifications, if they didn't, and if you had large fund investors with a broad, you know, public, all right, distribution of some of these investments in funds, and you know all the basic names of these players, that would have been dramatic,
right,
had losses gone out to those funds. But again, it's my understanding that from a legal standpoint, they could have drawn the line.
Okay.
All right.
So when do you think roughly was the first time the OCC may have had substantive discussions about the liquidity put vehicle with the folks at Citibank at either the senior management or board level?
Here's the other thing that is extremely important for you folks, and it's one message I will probably deliver multiple times before we're done with our session today. One of the things I think your commission needs to focus on is the responsibilities within a financial holding company and the segregated silos of regulatory oversight. This, if nothing else gets fixed, please try and address this, because in these large holding companies, and Citigroup was effectively a poster child of this, because it was the merger of a large bank and bank culture, being the former Citicorp,
right,
and Travelers. Now, Travelers, most people just think of the insurance side of Travelers, but Travelers had gone out and bought, all right, Smith Barney and Solomon Brothers. So they had a huge street broker-dealer, Solomon Smith Barney. And, you know, it really, once the merger happened and once legislation was passed, prior to that legislation, and I know this because I've been around for a few years, as you know, is the OCC had legal authority to examine any entity under a bank holding company. That was prior to the legislation after the Citigroup merger happened.
Right.
Then, in through legislation, basically, they created these functionally regulated entities and basically split the supervisory responsibility for overseeing a financial holding company. And the OCC clearly had its role in oversight of the national banks. The SEC clearly had responsibility for the U.S. broker-dealer. And at the top of the house, the Federal Reserve Bank had, you know, their umbrella responsibility for the whole of the financial holding company. And it's critical, and I know I'm sure you're doing this to review each person's responsibility in that. But what happened here is there was clearly divided responsibilities because the U.S. broker-dealer basically had the functioning operations of what was called the cash CDO desk and CDO warehouse activities. So, and again,
Oh my goodness.
We'll have a power.
They put in these lights.
Oh, if you don't move.
Yeah.
So do we need to stand up and walk around?
I mean, this is crazy.
Okay.
But it's energy saving idea. So that showed you how quietly we're proceeding here.
I guess
neither one of us are very
demonstrative. I'm not gesturing enough with my exactly. But basically, the broker-dealer, the U.S. broker-dealer, was the manufacturer of private label RMBS,
right?
All right, that fed, that it appears, and I'm saying it appears because it was outside of our supervisory jurisdiction, it appears that they were being manufactured and rated, all right, by rating agencies, and then fed into these special purpose vehicles. Now, in this instance, all those special purpose vehicles that represented those liquidity puts, that $25 billion of super senior exposure, were managed by other street names.
Right.
Okay? So you had a situation where an affiliated entity was generating, creating RMBS,
right,
and feeding those into those structured vehicles.
Correct.
That were getting rated. All right. Now,
can you, I'm sorry, define, what are you saying, RMBS?
Oh, residential mortgage-backed securities. Sorry, I'm glad. All right. So basically, pools of mortgage loans.
Right.
All right.
Well, and typically for the CDOs, what they with the subprime CDOs, yes, they were taking triple B and double B pieces and lumping them together and trying to get as many triple A tranches of the CDOs and the super seniors above the triple A's. Wasn't that the whole purpose of the CDO mechanism, was to sort of financial alchemy, turn lower rated tranches of residential mortgage-backed securities, some 70% of it or portion of it, into AAA-rated CDOs?
I can't answer that because we didn't examine
okay.
The manufacturer. All right, I do not.
That's my basic understanding.
And I do not want to,
sure,
you know, go out and basically,
okay,
you know, say.
Yep.
I mean, you need to talk to either the SEC or the Fed and ask them about their oversight of the
fair
manufacturer,
right,
of those instruments.
Right.
Right. But I will tell you that you asked a question before about substantive discussions with the bank.
Right.
Our, and again, this is going back to recollection, right, from a number of years ago. And if we want further discussions, the people that, you know, basically were more involved in, like, Coventry or the discussion on liquidity puts could come in and speak on it. But my take is that the view was the remoteness of the actual drawing or exercising of those liquidity puts, given the fact that the perception was that these things were highly rated, super senior, in other words, super AAA,
right,
that should never basically have happened. All right, so again, you know, and I think an example in here, and one of the exams you picked up was the asset-backed commercial.
Right,
the conduit. The conduit business.
Right.
Separate business, not the CDO, cash CDO business. A separate business that had existed, all right, I believe, previously in Citicorp, where here, different situation. Citi was the manager of this conduit structure. There were like four or five structures, maybe six. Don't, you know, hold me to exactly.
Right.
But Citi was the manager and basically had to do the underlying due diligence on the assets coming in. They had diversification criteria. They had credit criteria. They had that. And interestingly enough, these multi-seller conduits, as they're known as, held up through the contagion and continued to fund where almost across the board, almost every other securitization vehicle had extreme difficulties. Now, don't get me wrong. They paid a higher price for CP funding, which anyone who was able to basically get CP funding paid a higher price. But this was a different situation. Citi was a manager. So on that manager basis of those conduits, we basically had access. Right, it was not a broker-dealer function. It was,
right,
it was a Citi group function. CNAI was the legal vehicle.
Right,
but Citibank offered backstop protection to those conduits. So basically, we went in and examined that. Now, in these others, you're supposed to, and those trustees or managers are supposed to do due diligence. So it would be interesting in your, you know, work on this committee to,
right,
to circle back around to the other side and see what was done. But the other issue, you know, so I think the ability to examine everything under a bank holding company or a financial holding company is very, very important. Because what it also tended to do is, if I had authority to go in and examine anything I wanted, I would go in and examine it.
Right.
If I felt it wasn't being done, we would use our authority and we would go in and examine it. I think that's one thing that has to be significantly thought about as a part of your committee.
Absolutely.
I absolutely do. But I would think that if you get time and if you can, to go to some of those, you know, other managers and see what kind of credit criteria, due diligence they had and everything of things coming in. And you know, I'm not going to guess on that.
Right.
But that was another example of that.
So did you raise the liquidity put issue from the, because the liquidity put was from the National Bank, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes,
before
was.
These things ever
yes,
blew up, did you have discussions with management or the board saying, like, you know, what's going on? But it was just viewed as something
not,
so remote
not
that it never rose to that level.
With the board or not with senior management. My understanding is there were some discussions with management on the nature of a liquidity put and the remoteness of exercise and what kind of assets, just generally trying to, you know, try and get an understanding.
So it would have been sort of probably the people below you on your
exactly.
team talking to the operational folks
yep.
at Citi
yep.
at that level.
Yes. And I know that that I participated in one of those discussions with management.
Right. Was there any discussion ever about whether the transaction with affiliate provisions would apply to a liquidity put being issued by a national bank to support a broker-dealer structured offering?
I don't think there was any, because these were not city-managed vehicles, right? They were external,
right,
special purpose vehicles.
Right, they were being,
so the support, the liquidity put was not issued to an affiliate.
Right, the SBE was being managed by Bear Stearns, but city broker-dealer was selling the chunks into the SBE, and the only reason they could sell the chunks into the SBE was because they could issue commercial paper, because
of the liquidity backstop. That's right.
So it's like a triangle to get back to the...
The answer is no.
Okay.
I'm not aware that we pursued any legal questions as far as the authority. I think the view was, you know, that it was being issued basically to a special purpose vehicle.
Okay. Next document I have relates back to sort of the Enron issues. And I just wanted, this is the formal written agreement dated July 28th, 2003, at least that's when it was executed by the senior deputy comptroller. And so as I understand it, the basic purpose of this document wasn't to address sort of the safety and soundness type of issues that arose a few years down the road, but it was to address the sort of reputational and other issues and frankly the address the bad practices by the clients of the bank more than the bank's own credit exposure. In other words, prevent the Enrons of the world from committing accounting fraud or tax fraud by using some sort of vehicle that the bank had helped them create. Is that roughly accurate?
You need to speak.
Let me ask you this. Are you...
No.
You,
what I'm going to tell
you. Okay.
So you don't really have
you
any
need,
knowledge about this or the circumstances of the...
You need to speak to Scott.
Okay.
Put this on the Scott Waterhouse discussion.
Will do.
He was specifically involved with that. I came in. I did not look at any of the Enron structures, but Scott had someone else look at the Enron structures.
Okay.
And so I, you know, I would not be able to give you... No, anything other than conjecture or what I overheard.
Fair enough. So the next document is another one of these CMAC documents, and this one involves New Century. New Century was a subprime originator, and by, I think, 2006 they were one of the top two or three in the country. And
before you started, are you familiar with this?
No, I have never seen this
document. Have you ever seen it?
Okay. Nope.
Do you know anything about it?
No, I do not.
So, who should we talk to sort of understand better, do you think, if you have an idea, about this conduit structure for, it's called Extendable Commercial Paper Facility for Short-Term Warehousing of Subprime Residential Mortgage Loans. And the date of this particular document is August
20th, 2003. May I ask where you got this document from?
Yes.
Was it the 2005 credit derivative work paper? Because if it is, I think our next step is talking to the examiner in charge of that examination.
That is a good question. I'm not sure exactly which box.
But we should be able to go back and look at where it came from.
Do you have the base stamp number of those?
This is a document we just got on Monday, so
now,
it's not Bates stamped.
There was someone else, another team leader, who was looking at compliance with the formal agreement. Now that team leader has retired, right? But reported directly to Scott, who was looking at the formal agreement compliance and basically improvements to the CMAQ committee, right? Because I think part of the agreement, part of the formal agreement, and I'm just going off memory here now, you know, was to follow up on CMAQ documents and look at the progress and things that were made. So that is a possible person to speak with. But I think you might have to go through Scott, or if this came out of those work papers, if it came out of the formal agreement work papers, then I think you would have to ask Scott about it. If it came out of the 2005 credit derivative work papers, then I think we would have to go to the next level down, because I've never seen this document.
Okay. And what does CMAQ refer to?
The Capital Markets Approval Committee.
At Citigroup.
At Citigroup.
Citigroup.
It is one committee. It touches on not only bank activities, but non-bank activities as well. It is basically a committee that we started to require them to improve the quality of that committee. And
right.
You might have seen through some of our examinations, we found areas where things were not going to that committee that should have gone to that committee.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think that was a major issue that we tried to tackle over time. Right? But from an examination standpoint, a long time ago, it was not automatic that we reviewed every new product that the Capital Markets Approval Committee
right. Some,
and it's still not. I mean, to look at every single product that comes out of the new product approval committee is not something that, you know,
that was
can
one
be
of,
done per resources.
In my review, that was one of the things they were supposed to decide, was whether they needed to submit it to the OCC for approval
okay.
or not.
That, again,
but.
You mean in general or a particular product?
Well, each, you know, there were like several hundred of these that would go through each year, and my understanding, limited as it is that the CMAC would make a determination about, is this something we can approve, or is this something, before we approve it, we need to get the OCC to say we can approve it. That's right.
We have had discussions with their legal people over the years, because we've been critical of weaknesses in that process, and where we found, quite frankly, in, I believe, late 2004 and maybe early 2005, we found some products that were being traded in the bank that were not permissible. Hence, we said that, and we sent a letter, a supervisory letter, which I hope you have a copy of, I believe in January or February of 2006, but I can look that up, permissible. And Scott will be able to maybe give you a better sense of the date. But we basically put them on notice that, you know, certain transactions were not permissible to be done under the bank. So the CMAQ committee has to be the one that raises the flag if a new product requires regulatory approval because of legality or what other reason or not. So your understanding is correct. We made CMAQ basically the gatekeeper to say you need to have people on that committee that understand the legal aspects of the bank or the non-legal aspects of the bank. And if it might broach a legality issue, then it needs to come before the OCC.
Okay, and here is something that was in the file next. You can keep that. Next to that, and obviously you haven't seen this
no.
either. But if you can just take the time to read down, it's just the first page
yep.
down to the point where it says Citibank Canada Fund Linked CD. If
right.
you just read, take a few minutes to read that first
mm-hmm.
thing, because I'm thinking perhaps you can tell us who we might want
right.
to talk to after you've
yep.
read this. unfortunately, yeah. We didn't find any name on it.
Yeah.
Just sitting in the...
I would need to go back and look and see where this came from, which set of work papers, and that would lead me to be able to provide you the name of someone to speak to.
But this is when I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, the total return swap. See, but they're differentiated
right.
between... It looks like what happens sometimes at Citi is they'll raise a proposal and say, give a couple options. And there's a couple way to do this, either through a CP with a liquidity put or some type of backstop, or maybe separately a total return swap, which is the TRS structure.
Right.
And they may look at a few different options of how to do the transactions. And I'm not sure whether this is examiner notes or presume that it is examiner notes.
Well, it says need to have our conduit yeah. examiners look at this transaction.
Right.
And now, I mean, technically, it could, who knows, it could be FRB.
It
right?
could be.
I mean, we don't.
It could be.
We don't know. It's in your file.
I know.
It's not necessarily OCC.
Okay.
Product. But I'm just, so that was, this was the basis for my question.
Got it.
The total return
before
swap.
Before the total return swap.
And here it appears, you know, the examiner was saying that both credit risk and market risk are
right.
transferred back to Citibank. So unlike the liquidity put,
yep.
where it was supposed to be a contingent temporary yep. thing to just smooth over the ruffles, here, if this deal structure was actually adopted,
it would have included credit risk in it.
Right.
Okay. So we need to put it here, follow up, and find out who.
So was this document, which I'm going to call the August 20th,
well,
Doc, I mean, that's the date on it. Was this from the work papers?
Yes.
It's not from our electronic book.
No. Anything without a bait stamp is stuff that
okay.
we just got in
out
New York.
Box.
Yeah, well, so far everything does not have a bait stamp.
Well, yeah, the early stuff. When we get into the other stuff, there will be bait stamp
okay.
docs.
Do you want me to change from our report box it came from? Because the boxes are labeled.
We did when they were copied, but all they did was... write it on a sticky pad note, so that
okay.
information is
okay
gone. All right. The reason I pulled this document was it appears to be sort of the precursor to the 2005. This document is a March 29th, 2004 memorandum
yes. well,
regarding fixed income derivatives examination.
This clearly, I want to let you know that over the years, right, we have fought, as you can see, we have disclosed things and fought battles in this company. And fixed income derivatives was one of the first ones that we fought,
right,
myself
right.
involved. And
that's why you're here.
Exactly. Exactly. And quite frankly, you know, I'll say this, it's my own observation, but it was clear to me that there was a cultural disparity between what we used to review and that being bank trading activities and bankers, right? And I'm using the word bank literally and here versus what we were seeing as far as, because post-merger, right, the survivors were basically Travelers and Solomon Brothers, Solomon Smith Barney. So you had people that had been basically running trading activities in a non-bank environment. Fixed income derivatives, and I didn't pull this, you know, cover supervisory letter because, you know, it wasn't on your original list
right,
of
right.
documents. But I remember this one, you know, fairly well, although, you know, for details I'd have to go back. But clearly, this was the first major, you know, criticism that we took on the bank's trading activities following my, you know, in
right.
my tenure
right.
as team leader for, and it was significant. I mean, you could see we had the risk in fixed income derivatives as high, and the quality of risk management less than satisfactory. That's the key. You start talking less than satisfactory. We had a situation and I'm not telling tales out of school, where the business risk manager during that exam just decided that he didn't want to talk to us during the exam. Yeah.
In which
it was just
that's not
evidence.
Bushnell, that's below Bushnell.
That's correct.
It is Bushnell.
No, it is not Bushnell.
Okay,
it's not. It is not Bushnell. That was a business person.
Okay.
See, you have to remember there is independent risk management,
right,
and business risk management. They that tag is separate and distinct.
Right.
But it clearly showed that there were weaknesses in, you know, and again, I would probably want to go back through this to talk about it with you substantively, but I can, you know, independent risk management and access to the desk. I mean, one of our recommendations here, and this was called recommendations back then before we changed our moniker to matters requiring attention. You
right,
may
right.
see in later exams
right.
something called matters requiring attention and access to the desk, where we felt that independent risk didn't have as close of access to this front office trading operation as they should have. So we recommended that the business basically allow independent risk to sit up. That's one of the recommendations. But and here,
yeah.
CMAC, you know.
What page are you on?
Page 6. Oh, is this your... Yeah, all right. This is an extra copy.
Yeah.
But again, screening, review, and approve the model. Okay, actually, you can see here that we actually used this exam to come back and see whether or not we saw any deals in this trading desk on page 6 that might have been subject to the structured finance policy. So basically what we were doing is we were doing some work to support the assessment of the bank's changes to the structured finance policy. All right? To make sure that they didn't...
At this point, examining the bank to determine compliance
with
the formal
yes,
agreement regarding structured products.
You did not. I'd have to go back and double check as far as the date that the formal agreement was signed. But we were either doing this after the formal agreement to help Scott basically make the determination of compliance with the formal agreement.
It was signed July
28th,
2003.
So this would have been, yes, to feed the assessment of the formal agreement and compliance program. But yes, a critical exam.
Right. So, for example, on page 2, you know, again, the first paragraph, price risk is
yep.
high. Second paragraph, price risk
okay.
management
less
is less than satisfactory.
Correct.
And then the last sentence, overall, a stronger control culture needs to be fostered.
Yes.
I mean, these are sort of, these are the leading indicators of what eventually
yes.
brought grief to Citibank.
Yes, the control function. And you'll see through the years, because I don't think we were shrinking violets here. We were trying to tackle the cultural disparity of the former broker-dealer, because they wanted to move things into the bank. They liked that because it was cheaper to fund.
Right.
All right? So they had a decided interest to move things into the bank and expand derivative trading in the bank. And you could tell we were fighting some battles. And, you know, some of the ROE findings later on in the years 2005 and 2006, you know, clearly still supports the bank's need to improve their controls. But yes, definitely we had questions on their controls. Now, here's the interesting thing. We're evaluating one desk here.
Right.
And again, that's, you know, based on resources and the resources we have. And again, we've got few examiners and we ask more to come in to help us out, you know, on examinations. But this is our opportunity to try and, you know, lay things bare, so to speak.
Right.
And yes, this was, from my perspective, our first real attempt to raise control issues and raise cultural issues. And again, you'll see it in subsequent letters. And I think one of the interesting things about the 2005 letter is that right before we went in and did the examination, but I won't, you know, they curtailed some of their activities. Like, I mean, shortly before we went in to do the examination.
And when you refer to the 2005 letter, you're talking about the December.
Number one, the December 22, 2005.
Supervisory.
Letter.
Yeah, that's coming up.
Yeah, I know it is. But again, you know, we were involved with this. You know, and you can see the examiner in charge on this was Dan Stale.
Right.
Now, when was the merger? Because you said this was our first attempt.
This was my first attempt.
Your first attempt.
Of, you know, an examination where we had real issues in it. So I took over in early 2003. This desk, which what we try to do when we determine what we're going to examine, we look at those desks that may pose a higher degree of risk. So you could see we tackled or tried to tackle interest rate derivatives here.
Right.
And then we moved into credit derivative space and spent, you know, a large amount of time in credit derivative work. But this one's interest rate derivative.
Right. But when was the merger? Because that's what was creating the
culture problems.
1998.
Yes.
Yeah, it preceded Gramm-Leach-Bliley. In fact, right. Was one of the
motivating factors behind Gramm-Leach-Bliley
to prevent divestitures.
Right. Yes. You know, again, one of the chapters of many battles.
Right. Okay. I think the next document, September 23rd, 2004
okay.
letter.
Okay. Go ahead. This.
I think it relates to the
document. It does.
We just looked
this
at.
Back then, we changed our approach. This was a cover letter that basically went on top of this.
Right.
And this was basically, right, this was the conclusion memorandum. This was the cover letter dated September 23rd, 2004.
For the March 2004 memo?
Yes.
September to March?
That's March to September.
So were you
there was
having internal discussions?
Yeah. Oh, no, I don't
or was it
it
you
was
were having discussions
with the bank as well.
Okay.
With the bank as well. So that seemed to I have to go back on and look as to the reason why there's that kind of delay. Usually we don't see that much of a delay.
Yeah, usually I see like a week or so between the
but this is well not once we got to 2005 we did everything well not 2005 later on 2006 we did everything together.
Gotcha.
But yeah, usually it should be a couple weeks. This was a very significant examination.
So that
this raised
the
a lot of issues. There were a lot of discussions between us and the bank and making sure we had the right conclusions and that we had follow-up. But I'd have to go back to Dan to find out why there was that delay. Very well might have been due to the nature of the exam and the nature that it was the first time we had major substantive conclusions.
Right. So the next memo is a memo dated to September 27, 2004 from Bruce Johnson, the file. So I don't believe you've seen
I this have not seen that. Bruce reported directly to Scott Waterhouse.
Okay. It's
formal agreement.
It's minutes or notes of a meeting mm-hmm. that he had with management at City, including Mr. Bushnell and others. If I can draw your attention to page 2, the top paragraph under concerns number one, relativity and the boiling frog theory.
No, I have not seen this memo. I have no recollection.
Okay, so if you can just read that paragraph.
Okay. You know what BPCs mean here?
The Business
Practices Committee. Very good.
Yeah, we kept taking notes of all the acronyms.
Very good. I'm impressed.
But the PCAT, it changed meanings over. There were some different phrases. But my understanding of the boiling frog theory, which is not laid out in detail here, is that if you put a frog in hot water and you turn up the water gradually, that the frog won't pop out and it will sit in the water and get cooked. And so the examiner here, basically, as I understand it, is telling Bushnell and Farmer that they are too close to the business guys. And as risk managers, they're seeing every single deal every single day. And they're, like I said, there are hundreds of deals in front of the CMAC. And that he thinks that they need to, quote, dip their fingers in the pot to ensure the water is not getting too hot instead of not sitting in the pot all the time.
Get Scott's impression on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't.
Scott, I did not see it. I could conjecture.
Okay. He's not a good person.
Nope.
Yes. Okay.
Throw that one to Scott.
Right, now we're up in time to the June 13th, 2005 Notice of Failure to Meet Safety and Sound Standards, which I haven't read yet.
This may be another Scott.
Okay.
Right? Is that the part 30?
Yes.
Okay. You gave me a copy. But I had not seen that document before today as well.
So is this principally dealing with the problems in Japan? Or it says that's the most recent example. I guess it's broader than that.
Yeah. Let's see. Thank you. He might, and you should definitely ask Scott this. Japan, my recollection is Japan was the primary issue. But he says the bank had several significant breakdown in internal controls.
Right.
One of those also related to that permissibility letter that I mentioned earlier in the interview that went out, I believe, in January 2005. Right, that highlighted where things were being traded in the bank that shouldn't have been, and they didn't go to CMAC. So I think, but please clarify that with Scott.
Okay.
I think that will be his interpretation, but I'm not going to put words in his mouth.
Sure.
Right?
So this is a document dated September 19th, 2005, letter from Scott to Tom Rollay.
Rollauer.
It's pronounced. So I guess we will ask Scott about this.
I think that would be the appropriate thing to do.
All right. Our next document is a document from our friends at the Federal Reserve Bank that were in your files.
Okay.
And it looks like they were doing what I called in the prior life a scoping memo. And they're talking about a joint examination that they say is an OCC-led review of credit derivative businesses at seven institutions.
Yep.
J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Deutsche, CSFB, Bank of America, and Wachovia.
Right.
Were you involved in any of those?
No. Nope. And I don't. I was not.
Do you know who would have been at the OCC?
We might want to ask Dan, but I don't think he was either. Well, first, Deutsche Bank wouldn't have been ours.
Right.
Nor would have CS First Boston. JP Morgan Chase, B of A, and Wachovia might have, but I'm not aware. I'm not knowledgeable. I've never seen this memo before. It is very clear that they did not lead our OCC-led review of credit derivatives. It says part of its ongoing bank supervision staff will lead or participate in OCC-led reviews. I don't know what.
This is a Federal Reserve paper, right?
Yeah, it's.
I don't recall that the Fed even participated with us in this. I do not recall. I don't think that they did, but I could be wrong. They might have sensed.
Well, at least they thought, someone at the Fed thought they were going to, right?
We didn't even be on an examination bank.
And it did end up in your files.
I know.
So somebody got wind of it.
I don't know. They don't get it.
Yeah, it's just titled Overview of Credit Derivative Examination Work for 2005. It's not dated, and it's not and it's not signed.
Yeah.
And it simply says internal FR on the bottom, indicating the Federal Reserve. The next document is a Citigroup chart that I pulled out of the work papers.
Gotcha.
And the reason I was interested in this particular chart, and this is a 2005 document approximately based on the references to year-end 2004 and budget actual for quarters of 2005. But what interested me is the very first chart where it shows evaluation at risk dropping from 15-something billion, million, I assume billion given that it's CDOs, down to half that amount, 7 billion, in what looks to be an instantaneous period. And it says, valuation at risk, quote, was previously overstated due to infrastructure issues which have now been addressed, close quote.
Right.
So if I'm taking this chart at sort of face value, it says they were measuring something, but they were off by a factor of two because of some sort of infrastructure problem.
It also says U.S. CDO. All right. So where things say Citigroup,
right,
it may not or probably was not in the bank.
Right.
So, you know, what may have happened is a part of our request for information and work papers, the bank may have supplied this to us as something related to CDO. But I just want to clarify, I had never seen this this document before. And if it related to something outside the bank, our examiners may not have pursued the discussion on it. But if it came out of that 2005 credit derivative examination, then it may be worthwhile to follow back up with the examiner in charge of that. But my first thought is, you know, and I go back because one of our findings in our review of the fourth quarter 2007, which was the most critical examination, where we just laid everything bare.
Right.
We determined that the CDO exposure, and this is an interesting note, in London had not been pulled into risk systems or VAR systems. So how or whether this U.S. CDO actually officially made it into the VAR is a question I would have, and I don't have the answer because it appears that it's outside the bank.
Right.
So again, a question to the SEC or the Fed may be.
So somebody sent that to the OCC.
Well, when we put out a request letter, right, as part of examination, we basically ask for a lot of information.
Right.
Many times, and you've gone through the boxes, so I'm sure you've seen the many reams of information we get from the bank. But many times, what the bank will give us back, if they don't have something specifically on Citibank versus the non-bank entities, they'll send whatever they have. If it covers Citigroup, and I guess at the end of the day, you know, hope that that satisfies us. If we don't have enough, we'll basically go back and ask for additional information.
Right.
All right?
The next document I have is called Conclusion Memo, New York Correlation Desk / Credit Trading, and the name on it is Dan Skirsky.
I believe he's no longer with the OCC. But Dan Skirsky reported to Dan Staley, right,
okay.
Two Dans,
right,
on the credit derivative exam in 2005.
So, first of all, I'd like you to just explain to me the correlation desk,
yes.
I understand, did do some sort of CDO trading, but it wasn't clear to me whether it was involved in the ABS CDO SPE structure.
It was not.
Okay.
All right. My understanding, the ABS CDO, there was one desk within, well, the trading portfolio held the liquidity puts, right? That was in the credit derivative desk because that was in the bank. The ABS desk in London was where they did the synthetic trading.
Right.
All right.
What does ABS stand for?
Asset-backed securities.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Thanks.
They're the ones that did synthetic, and synthetic with mortgage product, and synthetic that was utilizing indices on subprime exposures. But this was not.
And what I read was that the London branch started doing that in early 2005. Is that?
May have been early 2005.
I think we'll get to it.
We'll get to it later. So let's save that. That's another story.
Okay. So this was different than
This
that,
was not.
But there is a sentence on the first page, last paragraph. The quality of risk management should be deemed as needs improvement.
Hang on. The quality of risk management should be deemed as needs improvement. Don't underline?
Yeah,
I'm
don't
sorry. All right. I apologize. I'll put the pen down. And you can note that mine is
we'll
blue.
Just,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
So what's your specific question?
So,
yeah.
In your capacity.
Yes.
Two Dans above this, were you made aware of the fact that the correlation desk also needed better risk management?
Yes, because effectively it was the correlation desk, all right, that drove. If you look into the cover memo that Dan Staley has, right, which was a part of this examination, and I'm sure you have it there. And you look on page 4, you need to go to this document. This is the supervisory letter. This is the credit derivatives examination letter. Hold on. That's the right one.
This one.
That letter goes on top of that memo.
Right.
If you go to page 4
right.
on that memo, and you look under price risk and correlation trading under the matrix.
Right.
Look at the rating, less than satisfactory.
Right.
Now,
and for the record, this is a December 15, 2005 memo from Dan, how do I pronounce his name?
Staley.
Staley to Ron Frank.
That's correct. So, here was a situation where, now, the reason we didn't use this term needs improvement, that's mine.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Got it. The reason we didn't use the term needs improvement is because at the time that was an audit moniker. Right? Auditor either had unsat, needs improvement, or sat. Right? Now, I think Dan Skirsky just maybe used consistent language with internal audit, although I don't recall that internal audit had identified these issues or not. But when we brought it up to our level, we basically put it in the vernacular of it's less than satisfactory. It is not acceptable. So here, my view on this memo to the final conclusion is this wording is consistent.
Okay.
All right?
So,
yes.
As long as we're here,
this is where
the battle is joined, right?
Yep. On credit derivatives.
On credit derivatives.
This is where we join the battle. And this is the one where the volumes, just industry volumes in credit derivatives, were growing by leaps and bounds. And quite frankly, this is the one where when we came in on the exam, they kind of reduced the volume of their trading right before we came in and started developing a remediation plan right before we started.
So you sent a letter saying we're going to do a four-week exam. They see
correct.
That you're coming.
Now, we discussed that with them, and I think they clearly said, no, that was not the intent. It was just, you know, coincidence or whatever. But this was, you know, clearly another very critical exam. Basically, a clear case of them wanting to do business and transactions without the appropriate infrastructure.
Right.
And we told them that that was not, they were out of control. Right. And actually, this was one of our first examples where we thought risk management was a little too close to the business from my capital markets perspective.
Right.
Because we thought that in that risk management, independent risk management now, under Bushnell,
right,
and under B.B. Duke,
right,
should have stepped in and restrained the business's activities. If you can't process, if you're using spreadsheets, if you can't generate risk numbers daily or P&L daily, you shouldn't be doing the volume of activities that they were doing.
Right.
All right? If they hadn't started to slow things down and start developing remediation plans, we would have elevated this and taken certain actions, which we threatened in this letter, as you read.
Right.
But we never had to actually do that because they did it themselves. But the other interesting thing that...
What was the action you threatened?
All right. We basically said in the cover letter dated December 22nd, 2005, we basically said, given this oversight failure on the page 2,
right,
we are considering options that would limit the bank's ability to perform future business. I wanted to basically let them know that we did not want them operating in an unsafe and unsound manner. All right, but the reason we didn't go further is because they reacted very quickly and started to say, we need to pull back, we need to do this. This was another one where we brought this discussion of risk management being too close up to senior management and Dave Bushnell. We asked him specifically why he allowed this to continue in what we viewed as, you know, unacceptable circumstances. And he told us, and Scott was in the room as myself and Bushnell, that he made the conscious determination that it was okay to go on. And we saw that risk management was basically trying to help facilitate, right? And our view was that, well, risk management shouldn't necessarily be trying to help. They should be trying to stand and until the business stop. And we actually put that in the year-end 2005 report of examination, which went to the board. And we said subsequent discussion with the chief risk officer indicated that he had approved the business's continued trading in these products. It is important that such decisions provide appropriate recognition to the underlying operational risks and not just the market risk.
Can you identify the document that you're reading from?
This is from the report of examination in 2005.
Page 12.
Page 12.
Great.
You got it. All right?
Lawyers know how to read upside down.
Yeah.
So if we...
So, go ahead. No,
you're... You know the stuff. I'm just asking the question.
Well, I'm giving you, you know, how we were elevating things.
Right.
Right? And clearly trying to curtail, you know, not only them operating in a situation where the business was flying and they were trying to fly along with it, but not being able to generate, not having good systems, not being able to generate timely P&L or risk positions. And you can go through this report. We can talk about, you know, whatever.
Well, let's go to page 4 of the December 15th
memo.
Where
the matrix.
So first of all, there's the matrix.
Yep.
The summary of the matrix.
Correct.
So as correlation trading, those are those other CDOs, right?
Well, they're not. Effectively, correlation trading, I'll give you my understanding of it. If you want more technical, we can go back to, you know, Dan Staley or whatever. But it's clearly trading and providing synthetically tranched exposure, right? Either long or short credit.
Right.
Whatever tranche anybody wants on either side, asset or liability. Now, correlation trading desks, when it's referred to, is basically corporate loans.
Right.
Okay, that's the differentiation.
Right.
We're not talking mortgage securities here.
So would mortgage securities be under the correlation trading, even though it's not correlation trading desk here, or would mortgage securities be over?
Remember, mortgage securities, non-bank. Gleba. And I don't know that this is a legal thing, but it must be. I don't know. I'm not the lawyer in the room. But after the merger, we have at least three of you, maybe four. I don't know. Scott, you're an attorney too. All right. I'm not. All right. But I can talk, you know, back. But what happened is all the cash trading instruments seem to migrate to the broker-dealer. So any cash trading instruments. Now remember, at Citigroup, you can never attempt to simplify anything.
Right.
Because there is always an exception or two or three or ten to every rule. But cash trading, agency, you know, govies, mortgage, right? Munis, all cash instruments, cash CDOs, were in the broker deal. When you moved into derivative space, there was some derivatives in the broker dealer, but most was in the bank, and that had to do with usually legal arguments or something like that. So it's important, and one of the things that made supervision difficult was trying to understand what was ours to examine and what wasn't ours to examine.
Okay, so let's go to the bottom of the document then before
yes.
we go back.
So
to
correlation
the
trading is basically corporate, basically.
Okay, let's go to the bottom
yes.
of page 4, top of page 5. It says most of the trades on the desk are
yes.
CDS hedges and index tranches
okay.
with a relatively small volume of bespoke transactions.
Yes.
The more complex synthetic transactions,
yep.
CDO squared and ABS CDO, are either done out of London or back-to-back into London for risk management purposes. The bank began using the London branch for booking various CDO products in early 2005.
Okay. So that was... Well, London also had, right, a correlation trading desk.
Right.
Right? But as it's saying here, some more complex and, again, synthetic, right, keyword, transactions, CDO squared, ABS CDOs, either done out of London or back-to-back into London for risk management purposes. So what we found out during this exam in late 2005 was that some of the business that we thought might have been, you know, wholly managed in New York had either been, you know, moved to London, had been started up in London, right, or, you know, or were being back-to-back into London. So,
and what
coming
is that?
Out,
what is back-to-back?
What it, means back-to-back is basically an expression for if a customer is a New York customer,
right,
and they want to do the trade with Citibank NA in New York, they'll do it with a trading desk in New York. That trading desk in New York will do a mirrored transaction, in other words, back-to-back, with the trading desk in London, because that's where the bank has decided that it wants to manage that risk. So when we rolled out of this exam, we basically said we need to go over and examine London too. So at the end of 2005 and early 2006, we put on the schedule the London, the EMEA Structured Credit Desk, which happened in early 2007, and quite frankly, probably, you know, later, given everything that transpired. It's amazing in hindsight how quickly things ramped up in 2006.
Right.
So that was basically a recognition that some of the risk exposures were outside of this New York desk,
right,
and that we needed to move on and go and take a look at that.
So this is where you basically got the information that you needed to look at London.
Okay. Yep.
Now, was London inside the bank or outside the bank?
Both. It's never easy at Citi. At Citi, they have a London, or a branch. They have a subsidiary of the branch that's a Reg K sub, all right, that was called Citi PLC, and Reg K subs are normally supervised by the Fed, but I don't think any real trading was done in the UK sub. And there's also a subsidiary of the holding company that owns the US broker dealer, and that is CGML, which is Citi Global Markets Limited. So that comes under the non-bank chain.
So all of the stuff you just described is in the non-bank?
No. Okay. Yeah, don't never try to simplify. That's my golden rule with Citi.
Citi PLC
is a subsidiary of the bank, but owned through its Reg K authority from an entity called Citi Overseas Investment Company, COIC, we know it as, COIC.
Okay?
But I believe the predominant trading was either in the branch or in CGML. And I believe CGML, again, like in the U.S., where cash instruments were in the broker-dealer and derivatives mostly in the bank, I believe that was a similar situation in the bank, with exception of FX, because FX had always been traditionally in the domain of Citibank.
And by FX, you mean foreign exchange.
Yes, exactly.
So,
go ahead.
At the bottom of page 4,
yes,
where it's talking about complex synthetic transactions,
yes,
ABS CDOs and CDO squareds, that's where we're getting to mortgage-backed product and subprime exposure,
synthetic,
correct? So they would have a credit default swap on the ABX index or some other subprime base.
Pretty much ABX index. And they started ramping this up in a big way when they basically stopped, and it's my understanding that Treasury and Citi put a limit on the liquidity puts at $25 billion. So when they hit that limit of $25 billion and management increased those limits, then they started basically ramping up exposure synthetically in London.
Now, so the city's internal treasury department put a $25 billion limit on liquidity puts, do you know when?
Roughly
05, 06?
I think it started in 05, but I'm not certain.
Okay.
I think, and I think it was low because there was a meeting that was had with Bushnell, which I think Scott can talk about better.
Okay.
Bushnell talked about raising limits, and they went from 10 to 20 and then went up to 25, all within a period of time. This is my recollection. I'm not certain of these dates.
Okay.
Between 2005 and 2006.
Fair enough.
It was in that window of escalation and ramping up.
Okay.
So this sentence that you're focusing on pages 4 and 5 of the December 15, 2005 memo, the more complex synthetic transactions, so on. Was that within our authority to examine or not?
Yes. Okay. Mostly it was. Okay. That is correct. And that's in the EMEA examination that we'll get to later on.
Right. So now to go back up to the box.
Yep.
So we've got ABS CDOs. Do those go?
Not up here.
So
not in here.
So
that's London. Not up in the box.
Okay.
This examination, again, this is where it was still very difficult at Citi because they were managing desks on a siloed basis. So there was a fixed income trading division in New York and there was a fixed income trading division in London. There was a credit derivative trading division in New York and there was credit division. Now, the good news, they consolidated these and basically, you know, made it a global managed business line after these exams. All right, so they stopped doing that. They got smart because it just made sense from a managing global risk rather than having two separate entities maybe managing things in different ways.
So the less than satisfactory
yes.
ratings on risk management, that's all New York based stuff.
Correct.
In this report.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, now you gave me these two. Is that to keep? Or
yes, that's part of your...
Okay, I would like to, unless you have any objection to this, I just like, I've been keeping track of the documents that we've been reviewing by just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. So I'd like to put the number, for example, the one we just discussed was number 12 on the documents as we go. Is that
sure?
Okay.
So
now, I'm just making a record that
right.
when I put a number on the document, it's my number from our discussion was not on the original document.
Right. So 12, is that the December 22nd letter or the December 15th memo?
Is the conclusion memo, which is...
The December 15th memo?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So 13 then would be the December 22nd?
Yes.
Okay. So here's a pair of charts that'll be mm-hmm. document number 14.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of showing the structure on one hand of a synthetic CDO
yep.
and the other of a cash CDO. On the synthetic CDO,
right.
What is a TROR?
Total rate of return.
Total rate of return?
Swap.
So on the right, it sort of shows the tranching structure,
yep.
which you explained
exactly.
earlier in the interview.
And the special SPV.
The SPV in the middle, that's managed by Bear Stearns or
yes,
some other independent.
Or some other independent.
The market would be the large mutual funds or other buyers of asset-backed commercial paper issued by the SPV.
Let's see. Well, this is synthetic then. This, what I talked about earlier,
was cash.
Was cash.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Because cash is straightforward.
Gotcha.
And so basically they're not showing, this is the investors over here, right? These senior, actually this doesn't show, you know, super senior basically, it just shows three. It should have an extra graph in there.
Right.
And all this is showing is that, I think Citigroup's role is to provide the warehousing facility for accumulation of assets. A third-party manager determines the collateral pool. So the SPV, you know, is the third-party manager,
right?
And they're supposedly doing due diligence, but Citi is warehousing assets, so I'm sure it's probably sourcing them as well. So this is the cash CEO structure.
That's on the first page.
Correct. But I've never. That's correct. And I have not seen this before, so I'm just looking at it.
Okay.
First
so the,
time.
The cash is on page one and the synthetic is on page two.
And so basically, you've got, and this is the synthetic. You've got an SPV. You've got the same, you know. Remember, Citigroup now, through the SPV, can create, right, the synthetically through CDSs,
right,
a portfolio of corporate credits. And remember, we're talking generally or mostly, if not all, corporate loans here, right? So you have individual loans, you have CDSs traded on those loans. They can create pools. It depends on what the investor wants. If the investor wants 100 names, if they want 500 names, that pool can be created and then basically tranched out based on, you know, their own models. And you hear the word bespoke, right? Basically, all that means is the investor wants a different range in the capital structure than what's traded on the index. So if, you know, a European index trades 1 to 4%, right, loss range, or 0 to 4, but the client doesn't want 0 to 4, it wants 0 to 6. It wants to take the top 6% of the losses in a portfolio. That's bespoke because it's off the index. It is a custom, basically a custom portfolio.
Right.
So basically, this is another structure. I don't know that, you know, in all cases, they're using a special purpose vehicle, but, you know, they create the pool of loans over here in Citi, all right? And then they basically give the SPV the exposure, and the SPV allots out to the equity, the mezz, and the other investors. And that's how synthetically. But the important thing to know is, instead of going out and buying individual loans, creating ABSs, or an asset-backed, or residential mortgage-backed securities, they're doing this basically in the corporate credit space through the correlation desks.
Right.
And they're providing whoever wants to trade with them whatever risk exposure they want and whatever tranche they want.
Right.
Okay? It's not as vanilla, clearly, as the cash structure.
Right.
Okay?
So the next document, 15, is a response.
Yes.
To your letter. Yes. It's dated March 6th, 2006. Let's see who's the signatories.
Yep. He's no longer there.
So
there's a lot of that.
There is indeed.
Yeah, there is indeed.
Thank
goodness, actually.
Right. So in your letter, you said, essentially, straighten up and fly right, or else we'll take action.
Correct.
They had begun to level out the risk before the exam.
Yes.
And you said that after they got the exam report, they began to take the steps that you believe were necessary to.
That is correct. Get on the right.
So, yep. So is this letter sort of the affirmation of them?
Of what their plan is, their formal response to our examination.
Go to page 11.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. credit derivatives.
Yep.
Under bespoke CDO tranches, mm-hmm. active CDX index trading coupled with consensus tranche pricing received from market on static bespoke tranches will be used to verify.
This is the CDX side.
CDX is what you said. It's a
U.S.-based
index of corporate credits.
Yep.
Correct. And so they were using that index synthetically by doing CDS.
Or they may have been using... Well, they're, I think what it's talking here is how they were basically trying to perform product control or pricing on the derivative portfolio. So the traders are doing something, but then at the end of the day, the product control division has to figure out a way to independently price the bank's books. Because you can't have, you know, traders determining prices at the end of every month.
They make profits every month.
Exactly. Yeah, bingo. To be found at some point. So really, you have the operations function trying to go out and using indices and then using, you know, basically using existing indices and then finding marks or interpolating off those marks to try and get back to the pricing on the bespoke. Remember? Because this bespoke are the trades that are basically non-index. In other words, they're off the index. So you basically have to figure out a way to take an index and then replicate it for if you added X more of losses or if you added or if you subtracted losses on each individual tranche. It's complex, but that's what they're trying to say. And they get pricing from Market, a firm that I don't know if you've ever heard of.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
So then on page 3, on that
three, yeah,
second paragraph,
okay,
the last couple of sentences, lingering control and stability concerns on the correlation desk,
yes,
both New York and London, prompted management to slow trading momentum in May 2005 and finally dramatically reduce execution of new risk-taking transactions on September 23rd, 2005. The correlation desk continues to operate within significant trading constraints. So this is...
Correct. This was their response back to us saying, okay, we get it, or I think that's their response. We get it. We're, you know, we slowed things down back in May. We want to let you know, but we basically dramatically curtailed in September 23rd. So that was, I believe, their attempt to tell us, okay, you know, kind of a recognition that of our findings and that basically they didn't want us to put them in the penalty box is basically the story.
Right. Okay.
Now, again, you know, this... There's one other point that's important here. Somewhere around this exam, there was a separate interagency function that started, that really started to try and improve the derivative operational risk infrastructure. It is a separate interagency group with the Fed, the OCC, the FSA. You may have heard of it.
This is the concern about the trades piling up.
Exactly. And there was not only trades piling up, but there was a process called novation, where you could basically just move a trade from one counterparty that you did a trade with, and hedge funds were notorious on this, to your prime broker. And the originating bank of the transaction didn't realize it no longer had a hedge fund on the other end of the trade. But it wasn't only that. It was standardization of documentation. We basically, and I have been sitting as a member of that committee along with our policy folks here, worked on a parallel track to try and what I would characterize as improve the plumbing of the credit derivative market per se. Now, at the end of the day, it didn't really deal with the issue of liquidity puts, right? But it was trying to deal with some real market issues and some plumbing, which in hindsight, after what we went through in 2008 with some large-scale failures, the fact that all those efforts had been taken on the credit derivative market made a big difference. Had we not run that separate, you know, regime and improving, standardizing contracts and basically improving trade flow, things could have been worse with some of the demise of the big
Lehman.
Yeah, basically that was the one. It's a little bit of a sidebar, but it's a good, you know, a good story in the midst of plenty.
The fire that was put out.
Yeah, plenty of a good story in the midst of plenty of not good stories.
So when was that?
It might have started back in 2005 or you know, 2006. Maybe it was even before that, but it's been running for quite a few years. I could get you the date if you just make a note. I'll look back and see what I have. Okay.
So the next document.
Yes.
All right. What are we at? 16.
Yeah.
16.
Yep.
16.
This one we probably shouldn't spend a lot of business time on it. And I'll tell you why.
Okay. Let me just
clean, well run. Go ahead.
Let me just. I don't
write
the
number. Yeah.
It's dated March 2nd, 2006, and its subject is the examination of the asset-backed commercial paper conduit business.
Yes.
So explain to me why
this is
not the SPE
asset-backed
commercial paper.
This was a bank-managed business. This was not managed by other Wall Street firms. It was managed by Citi. Right, actually CNAI, City North America Inc., and basically had very strong credit criteria, right, and due diligence audits and a lot of processes. This is called the multi-seller conduit business. So basically you had a lot of Citi's clients basically wanting to, you know, sell to Citi in this conduit, or this four or five or six conduits, as I mentioned before, some of their trade receivables, all right? Their own, you know, a huge corporate client sells their trade receivables into some of these conduits, but there were very strict credit controls, diversification controls, and basically these products did not end up with toxic assets. Now, that being said, you know, there was a very diverse product set from multiple sellers. And when they talk about multi-seller, that's anyone who sells assets into these conduits. But the processes underlying credit, the processes underlying audits, all right, audits not only of the assets but of the individual seller and their processes underlying. We went in basically because it was a business Citi managed itself, and we wanted to make sure they were basically doing what they needed to be doing and that this was a relatively, you know, well-run and moderately risked book.
So explain to me how if the guys at Citi NA could do asset-backed commercial paper in a safe and sound manner, not create something that was going to blow up and that they'd have to voluntarily take back onto their balance sheet.
How could the other?
I mean, if these guys know the score, you know, it's like, how could they miss it so badly on the other side?
You're asking for conjecture here, right?
Well, yeah.
Right? No. You're asking for my opinion.
Your opinion.
On something. And part of the opinion goes back to the cultural disparity between what the bank had originally done and bankers who understand safety and soundness of a bank and who understand credit controls, that's the key, versus the culture of the broker-dealer. That, you know, if something's rated, you know, again, I'm speaking generically of my knowledge of
right.
the culture on the other side and some of the interactions I have seen here. But clearly we've been making substantive control improvements and recommendations, which to me were indicative of some of the people that had come in from the other side based on the merger. Because the bankers basically lost out in that merger, right?
Right.
John Reed lost out
right.
at the top, and you could just see it running out the door. So how could they? Extremely large company, extremely complex company, very siloed company, and varying cultures, depending on the desk you went to. We don't look at, you know, we look at foreign exchange generally very well managed, very well run, right? We haven't, you know, spent a lot of time examining it because it's controlled. Of course, products are a lot less complex there too, right?
Right, right.
But again, bank control environment versus non. How could it happen? Great question. You know, A, management, you know, obviously was behind what they did and why they wanted to do it. But there were other pressures, you know, pressures that come down from the top. But culture is very, very important. And, you know, we talked about that instance with Bushnell. You know, it shows a culture of kind of wanting to work with the business to help them facilitate things rather than, hey, shut it down.
Right.
Shut it down until you get it fixed. Show us you can manage it and operate under safe and sound conditions, and then we'll let you start up again. It didn't happen.
So, you would have to be, if you're talking about management of Citigroup, you would have to be in a high enough unit so that both the banking side and the non-banking side reported to whoever
to
have your mitts on both
yeah.
the well-run
yeah.
ABC
P
business. Conduit business
right.
in the bank side and the
yeah.
other than well-run
correct
SPE
correct
business. Okay, well, let's go on to the next document, 17, which is a March 31 transmittal of the, I assume it's year-end 2005, Board of Examination.
Oh, okay.
Unless you had something else.
No, I'm going with you. All I did, and quite frankly, you know, I know this interview came up very quickly, but I didn't have an opportunity to go through the work papers. So,
right.
But what I wanted to do is make sure that I had the story on all the exams you specifically asked for documentation on. So that's what I brought
right.
with me, just documents. But
so this is the document that has the page 12 that you
okay.
were reading from earlier, right?
My page 12,
I
yep.
believe.
So this
I'm
is
sure
the report of exam.
Report of exam
for
the 2005, year ending 2005, which was transmitted to the board in March of 2006. And yes, this should be the same. Page 12. Price risk.
Yep.
And in that second paragraph is where we talk about weaknesses in controls. And then we also talk about the Bushnell issue.
Right. So that at the time that you had made these findings,
yes.
If I've got the sequence right, you had discovered that something was going on in London, but you had not yet begun
the
examination of the synthetic
That's
CEO
correct.
Book in the London branch of Citibank NA.
That's correct. Yep. And we knew, coming out of the 2005 exam credit derivatives, that we wanted to examine that London desk, not only because we found out that they had some, you know, an ABS structuring desk over there, but also because of the fact that we found processes so deficient here in the States.
Right. Right.
And again, this comment here, we remain concerned that control functions may not feel empowered to limit or restrain the business when necessary. We're certainly sending the board a number of observations.
And did you have a closing meeting with the board? With
Scott did.
Scott would be the person to ask about that.
Yep.
Is there anything else in this exam report that you would like to draw my attention to?
I specifically focused on price risk, right?
Okay.
And that aspect of it. I think what's very important, and it's interesting because you're interviewing me and John and Scott, you know, they are both the examiner in charge.
Right.
They're the one. Anything I do or I write, I draft for them.
Right.
Okay? They've got the big picture. I think, you know, if you're broadening a question to say anything in the report, you know, that should go to the EIC and they should respond to that. Things specifically related to the oversight of trading and our view of what happened and management, things like that, is obviously my purview and the reason I'm here with you.
Right. Okay, let's go to page 16 then.
Okay.
I'll
take a look at it. Yep.
Audit and risk review section.
Okay.
First paragraph, it says, we identified an instance where business monitoring should have been more aggressive in overseeing and limiting growth in the London structured credit business. This suggests it will take some time for these changes to become fully effective. So what do you know what is being referred to when we say the London structured credit business?
Hang on. What year is this? Six. Maybe there is a good story here, but I don't know. I have to go back and research it. There might have been. I'm trying to recall. Oh, boy. I somewhat recall being highly critical of their business monitoring practices in not maybe downgrading or calling question into some of the things that we observed in this 2005 exam here in New York, which might have prompted us to take a look and see if something similar was going on in London, but I cannot recall. I will need to follow up on that. Let me.
Okay, let's mark
that. That's a. I can't write on that. I don't remember.
I guess it doesn't.
No. I only did it once. I'll try to behave. Business monitoring. In London. There was something that drew our attention to London. We talked to audit, had interactions with audit, and basically criticized them for their business monitoring. That's what audit at Citigroup calls their activities between audits. So we thought that they should have picked up on things, and it might have been related to this exam that we asked them, what's the operating condition over there? And maybe prompt this thing, but I will get
okay.
You the answer.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. We have been going over 2 hours.
Do you want to take a break?
Yeah, I'm just giving everybody an opportunity for
sure.
A break.
So. That'd be good.
Okay.
And take 5 or 10 minutes
sure.
Or something.
Sure.
All right, please.
You want to jerk something off?
We are pausing at 11:10 a.m.
Okay.
We are restarting the recording at 11:16 a.m.
So the next document, I'll mark both copies, is number 18. It's another one of these
Before we start, I'm sorry, can we just describe? We went back and numbered all the documents according to the order that BART has pursued thus far.
Right, and there's and the only, I think, sort of correction is we've got 13A and 13B, 13A being the December 22nd, 2005 transmittal letter signed by Mr. Frake, and 13B being a memo to Mr. Frake dated December 15th, 2005 on the North American Credit Trading and Global Structured Credit Derivatives Examination of North America. So, number 18, this again is a package of material referencing essentially a review by the CMAC.
Right.
And what it looks like to me is that this one was brought to the attention of the OCC examiners.
Yep. Yes, clearly, because I see the examiner's name.
And it involves CDS on mortgage and asset-backed securities, including, if I understand the cover page correct, the ABS index, which is the subprime index. So this is what you would need to do to put together a synthetic CDO based on subprime mortgages.
Yep. And that would have been something done out of
the London branch?
Correct. Yep.
So I don't know if you're familiar with this.
I am not.
At all.
I had not seen this. And as a matter of fact, this OCC examiner is still on the staff. She reported to Bruce Johnson. Bruce is the one that was monitoring CMAC activities for the purposes of following the formal agreement. I'm just...
So just reading the... And I don't know if this is something that the examiners wrote, but it says examiner comments on the very first page.
Yes, but hang on.
Okay.
On the very first page, where does it say?
Examiner comments.
Okay.
This
oh,
page.
Okay.
So who would have
this is one that it appears went up through Bruce.
Let me ask you this: was this from the work papers that you?
It was probably it was from the formal agreement work papers.
Okay.
I had no knowledge of this document. At the end of the day, I wish I would, but this was reviewed by an examiner who was working for Bruce to determine that they were doing, that CMAC was doing things in accordance with what they should. Now, I don't know, but I would like to look back at the work papers we had in our London ABS exam, because I would like to see whether or not this was given to us as a part of our request letter. And if it were, then I would, you know, certainly know that our examiners under the capital markets group had looked at this and had one way or another opined on it.
So is this document...
If I recall, and my recollection is far from perfect, this document was in a binder with a bunch of other CMAQ-approved or reviewed transactions.
Scott needs to explain. I haven't seen it.
I want to clear up. Is this first page of the document, which we've marked as 18, is this a bank-created document or an OCC examiner-created document? If you know. If you don't know, just say you don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But it does say... It does say OCC examiner on the top. It looks like it may have imported something from a bank sheet, like on the top of the first page. But this looks like maybe a template Scott would know that was used by Bruce Johnson to track CMAQ activity. I think it's important that you chat with Scott because he felt that the tracking of CMAQ and the importance of it with regard to the formal agreement was best done by Bruce. He separated and had a separate team leader, Bruce Johnson, cover that so that it could be done in a way that he was satisfied with. But I'm hopeful that it's in our ABS work papers in London.
Okay. So,
what's the product name? CDS on mortgage and asset backed securities.
If you can turn to the seventh page of this document, it's a
They're not numbered.
No.
Sorry. That's all right. Is it this?
No.
Oh, all right. Good.
I'm looking for the page.
Right.
It's titled Product
Control.
Slash Control Summary CDS on MBS slash ABS.
And dated January 9th, 2006.
Right. So down below overview, it says the GFI Global Securitized Markets Mortgage Trading Desk seeks authorization to hedge, blah, 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 blah.
And you know what? That's outside of the bank.
Okay.
That FI, Global Securitized Markets, Mortgage Trading Desk, is outside the bank. So it was these individuals who are listed here as business sponsors. That were basically proposing
So if it's outside the bank,
well, see,
nothing's ever easy.
Herein, no, and it's not only that, but herein lies the comment that I brought up to you fellas earlier.
Right.
In these mega companies that have activities that are in bank and outside of bank, you know, the crossover and trying to determine what's ours, what's not. Here we're clearly sponsors of a product. Sponsors of a product that they may or may not have spun off people that had been under their control and put them under the bank or not.
Right, because if you go up, it says legal booking entity.
Yes, I see it.
Citibank N.A.
Yep.
So you've got someone outside of the bank
proposing
a product for
the
bank.
It's cheaper. And remember, it's not only cheaper. The bank's credit rating is higher than the holding company or the broker-dealer. And that's why the bank gets cheaper funding. And that's why the bank ultimately was the recipient of some of these assets that the holding company or the broker-dealer couldn't fund, basically. The bank had deeper pockets. And I think as you look at the losses and the distribution, you want to look at results of Citibank N.A., and while it did sustain some losses in 2008 and 2009, there was nothing near the company's losses. But there's a lot of reasons. You know, this one's just...
So would an individual at a trading desk in London be able to do both cash deals, which would then be at the broker-dealer, and synthetic deals, which would then be at the London branch of the bank? Would one person, in other words,
could
be straddling the legal entity line and working for both all houses of Citi? Or was there a delineation? It's like,
well,
Bart's on this side of the desk, Scott's on that side of the desk, I do synthetic, he does cash.
I don't know for certain, but no structure would surprise me.
Okay.
All right? I think normally, they have trading desks that facilitate transactions for both clients of the bank and clients of the broker-dealer. But at the end of the day, depending on where the clients are and where the legal docs are, it goes back and gets ultimately booked on the broker-dealer. So wherever those legal docs are,
right,
the underlying, you know, supporting the trading activities. So you could have a desk that trades a product for both the bank and the broker-dealer. Hence getting back to that same message, which I told you I'd deliver many times. Having separation...
I've been fairly warned.
Yeah, all right. Having separation is untenable.
Right. Okay, let's turn to page two. Or just the second page.
Gotcha.
Actually, number page two. Bottom paragraph.
Yep.
Since May of this year, with the review and permission of independent risk, the mortgage desk has taken over a small book of ABCDS trades originally booked by the CDS desk and has added a tightly limited number of additional trades. And then it goes on for details. So the mortgage desk is
outside.
Outside?
Yeah, the bank.
Do we know where outside would it, or would you?
I would presume, yes, someone certainly in the bank. But our understanding has been the mortgage trading desk, all right, has been outside.
Okay. And the CDS desk is?
Well, the CDO cash desk. The CDS desk, I believe, is a bank desk.
Okay.
I believe. But again, you're asking me questions on a document I haven't seen before.
Right.
But I suspect that the CDS desk is this trading desk that we evaluated back in the 2005 exam.
Okay.
Right? And it's basically trading credit derivatives. So that would be bank.
And if we turn to page four, with sort of the second full paragraph, I think this references sort of the plumbing issues you had mentioned earlier. Regulators recently raised concerns.
Yes, that is. Yep, and it's referring to the industry backlog and unconfirmed corporate CDS trades, but not formally novated. That is exactly what it's referring to, that interagency group.
So yeah, if I understand the process and if I understand this document, and both of those are a bit of a leap.
That's all right.
this was sort of the entry point of Citibank NA into CDS on
subprime.
On subprime, yes. CDS.
I would say you're right.
And so if one turns to page 10, not counting 10, but in that, in that same section that we're in, if you keep going to page 10.
Right.
There's Roman 6, credit risk
okay.
considerations. Second paragraph says, the long maturity and amortizing nature of ABCDS swaps requires a different credit exposure than a corporate CDS.
Okay.
Because, skipping to the next paragraph, mm-hmm. because the mortgages underlying ABCDS have a 30-year tenor, and technically mm-hmm. maturity circumstances would raise extended exposure concerns for credit. In actuality, the amortizing nature of swap underlying the swap create a much shorter maturity, which is better represented by mortgage-weighted average life, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Basically, they're talking about, you know, the prepayment characteristics
right.
Of a mortgage. And even though you have a 30-year maturity, it's going to clearly be less than that in duration with prepayments and things like that. So it's just saying it's different than a corporate loan that
right.
may be 5-year exposure or 1 year or whatever.
So it concludes, it says, for all trades, the existing CIB credit
right.
processes will be followed.
Okay.
So
that would be the corporate and investment bank. All right. Today, the name of that entity is the ICG, Institutional Clients Group. But at the time, the CIB was the corporate and investment bank. Pretty much, there's some changes between the two, but those monikers. So what they're saying is that their normal credit processes will follow on these transactions.
And the corporate and investment bank is?
Both.
Both.
Yep.
Okay.
The complexity of this place cannot be understated.
So the corporate investment bank was both in the bank and outside
yes,
the bank?
Yes, that is correct. The corporate investment bank is a business group. It is a very huge and vast business grouping that includes corporate credit, it includes trading outside the bank as well as the broker-dealer. It includes most of the wholesale activities across all legal entities.
So was it located in the holding company?
Well, no, not necessarily. You can have a business grouping, all right? It covered the bank, the broker-dealer, and then you go offshore and it can cover different legal entities overseas as well. It's just a paper designation of a business where they've assigned a corporate officer, all right, to oversee all the activities under that business.
Okay.
So clearly for them, more the focus is on business unit and not day-to-day on legal vehicles.
So is the corporate officer in the bank holding company? Or is he on lots of different organization charts?
He's on one organization chart for the purposes of defining that business, all right? Now, in reality, you know, he crosses over a multitude of legal vehicles. Like, virtually all the activities in London would come up through the corporate, except some of the consumer businesses, which would go back up through the consumer business head. But it's basically up to the compliance officers and legal to sort out where things go and why and how. And again, one of the more recent things after this crisis is better reporting and governance over legal vehicles. Not, no surprise there. So it's the ultimate in complexity. And no other banking company is as complex as Citigroup. That's why I say never simplify.
I've certainly never seen documents this complicated in any living or dead bank I've looked at.
Well, you know what? I don't know if you get to the likes of the trading activities in, you know, the mega banks, the J.P. Morgan Chases and those entities where they're trading in exotic products. They better have, you know, complex documents. But the whole reality is you got to try and make those complexities reasonable and visible, right? Transparent.
Right.
And that's the other issue. Yes.
So we'll move on in our timeline.
This one I want to get a copy of.
Okay.
I want to personally read that one. I'm going to put that on my to-read list. Yes, Bruce Johnson again.
Number
we're back
19.
To Scott.
Yes.
Bruce is basically doing all the work for Scott on compliance with the formal agreement.
Okay, so for the record, document 19 is November 21st, 2006, memo from Bruce Johnson to Scott Flaunterhouse recommending removal of the formal agreement.
Correct.
So have you seen this document before? Were you involved in that
process? Not that I recall. The only, I did not see this document before. What we did in my world was we would, as we went through exams, we saw evidence of it, you may recall, in the formal agreement, not the formal agreement, the fixed income derivative exam, where we saw that sentence in there where we didn't note any transactions that would have been considered as applicable to the structured finance policy.
Right.
That was our input to Bruce, basically, for the formal agreement. So when we went in and performed an examination, and I would expect all the EICs to say the same thing, we would look at and sample some transactions to see whether or not we would have determined them to be subject to the structured finance policy, and as such would have fed that information back to Bruce. But I definitely was not overseeing Bruce, Scott was, and was not overseeing the overall conclusion from Bruce. Scott will have the story for you.
And on page 3, this document also represents another one of these committees at Citi, the PCAG.
All right, hang on. Where is it?
On the top of page 3.
So you're asking him if he knows what
PCAG
is?
Yes. Hang on. Let me read.
On page 2, it says PCAG, a special unit within AR.
Within audit.
Risk and review.
Oh, what was it called?
I've seen it called two different things.
Yeah, I remember this. I remember PCAG. I remember hearing PCAG.
So what? It's not necessary that you tell me the name, but do you know sort of what the function? Was it basically a compliance with the agreement?
Yes.
Function.
I believe
the CMAQ was new products. PCAG was going like, okay, whatever we're doing, does this comply with our formal agreement with the OCC?
I think it was a group set up to look at compliance with not only their complex structured financial transaction policy, all right, their structured finance, but it was all a few other associated topics. Scott or Fred, you know, would know that in their, Scott would have the answer to that. I never interacted really with PCAG. It was most likely Scott or Bruce.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, but I can't.
No.
Oh, yeah.
This is the one you want to copy.
That's the one I want to copy.
So on to document 20.
Yep. Okay.
So.
Oh, are you putting the numbers on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, this is the exam.
Right.
All right. This is our year-end 2006 report of exam.
Right.
All right. Which was transmitted to the bank April 5th.
Yes, there. It's technically it's two documents, I guess. One is the Part 30 notice and Part 30 compliance plan letter to from Grace Daly to the
right.
Board of Directors dated April 5th, 2007. And the other is the transmittal letter dated April 5th, 2007 and examination report as of December 31st, 2006. So why don't you take me through this examination report and tell me what the...
Well, I'll take you through the price risk side of
right.
the examination
right,
report.
Right, right.
I'm
right.
just clarifying. I'm getting
you,
it now.
What part you know.
You know, and again, I think, well, actually, Grace was... No. Grace did the cover letter, but Scott was the EIC.
Right.
Right, so
right.
so if
so he
you
gets
want,
a whole ball of wax.
Yes,
you,
he does.
You take me to your piece.
I take you to my piece,
right.
and
so what piece is yours?
Price
on
risk.
Page eight.
Okay. I think. What were we trying to?
So what's your question?
Right. Yeah, is there a question on it, or are you just
I'm just looking for
asking for
an explanation of what the what basic message you were sending Citibank
right.
with this section on price risk, what your assessment at the time was, and what you know what you think about it now.
Got it. Yeah. There's always, you know, one of the things I think in a bank as complex as this, as you look back in hindsight after a crisis, and it's always a lot easier to do that, right? I mean, 20/20 hindsight, you know, you don't have a crystal ball anymore. You saw what transpired. But I think what's important to say is, you know, what are we saying? And I guess at the end of the day, we're considering the overall risk as moderate. All right, and there's a lot of trading activities in Citi. That's why, even with the problems you may have, and the major problems you may have, which you've seen manifested in here, we try not to indict the whole of the group. We try to isolate the outliers and raise that to them. Okay. I think because the bank with credit derivatives, and this is the, you know, because they had, from our knowledge, started reducing exposure and doing things in a more controlled basis than in the past, we felt that we could go with the overall risk assessment as satisfactory. We have questions in here, and again, model validation is one. If you look back on these reports, model validation has been a pretty consistent theme throughout the reports of examination as having significant concerns not only in their abilities but in their staffing levels. Now, we've basically moved that from a situation that was untenable in the early part of the decade to now their model validation group has like approximately 25 people in it and are finally, you know, have caught up and got rid of the backlog. So they have independent risk quants that are actually, you know, getting through all the models on the front office desk and not. That's been an issue throughout running through these reports for a long, long time. But again, this is an attempt to take the exams we did during 2006, which one was that, you know, well, the review of the conduit business was in early 2006, but that was fairly clean, and,
right.
and that wasn't necessarily a trading-related business. But I think in the credit derivatives, what we had seen through the years on there working to resolve the problems, I think we saw some system fixes and improvements enough to say that overall, you know, management was satisfactory. And I guess as you look back, the issue we raised with Bushnell and risk management, it's sometimes hard when you're in a seat to say you have a bit here. You know, you have an indication, your gut tells you.
Right.
Right? That risk isn't standing and drawing the line in the sand, right? And making the hard call when it needs to. Right? So, but in a bank this size, you know, with the reams and reams of control processes that reportedly they have and are working, right? You tend to say, well, if I don't have any, you know, anything that's outright damning, you know, it's hard to elevate it in a report that covers this much work and that type of thing. So I think, you know, we're raising the issues that we saw at the time and basically talking about the complexity of the company and basically saying that any proprietary trading they want to do needs to be done selectively and in instances where risk-reward characteristics are in its favor, right? And beyond that, I think we're recognizing that management has hired some extra staff. And I guess at the end of the day, we felt that they had responded positively to the exam in 2005 and the other issues and compliance issues that had been raised through the exam response, through the MOU and or the Part 30, I guess, the compliance issues, and it had bolstered compliance. And again, I thought, you know,
so at the time you thought they were listening.
We thought they were listening to us.
In retrospect, at least the guys like Maharis.
Right. Well, in retrospect, you saw our view at the year end 2007.
Right.
And the interesting thing is, yes, we thought Maharis was listening to us. But at the end of the day, remember, Maharis was a mortgage guy.
Right.
And was a main trader of mortgage products and
right.
Solomon Brothers.
Right. Right.
And I think, you know, if you had 1,000 examiners, you know, here at the end of the day, if management wants to do something, I guess they'll find a way to do it. And you try to look in under every stone where you can, you know, given the resources you have. And quite frankly, any examiner, I don't care whether it's us, SEC, whatever, you have to rely on the bank's own control mechanisms. And that's why largely when you see us recommending something, we're attacking it from the standpoint it doesn't look like risk is engaging the business. You know, risk, you need to do that. Board, you need to be aware that there's weaknesses in risk and they're not stopping the business from doing something. You ought to think about this or you ought to do something about it. And again, to do our job in the best ability, you have to have it. And at the end of the day, it's tone from the top.
Right.
It comes right from the top. I believe if the company wants earnings to make the next quarterly projection, you know, it's going to do it. Although, you know, obviously you try to find, you know, where the significant hits are going to be. But at the end of the day, the bank clearly, you know, sustained losses. But I think the bank, as you look at the financial underpinnings of it versus the rest of the company,
right,
it was able to basically take on a number of things that if the bank hadn't been there, you know, who knows what would have happened.
Right.
But as of this time, at the end of the 2006 exam,
we thought they were listening to us.
You were satisfied with the controls that were in place and the improvements that they made.
And the improvements that they made and were making to address our exam findings. Yep.
Now,
except for model validation.
Right.
Where we clearly said, you know, that's an issue, remains an issue of concern.
Now, do you know when your folks would have, in the London branch, would have looked at what was going on in time-wise? Because we were looking at that last exam.
It was after
this. So it
was first quarter.
Okay.
We did the exam, and that's coming up.
Okay.
All right, in the first quarter of 2007.
Okay.
So it was right, you know, at the same time or right after this was. And I think, here, the exam was, the transmittal was in May 8th of 2007.
Okay.
Okay, so our exam was a first quarter of 2007.
And so this is transmitted on April 2007.
Yes.
But this is
but this report is as of year-end 2006.
I'm sure you
right.
No.
Right.
So really, what we saw in London, obviously, when we saw the price risk was high, and I know we'll get to that, so I won't steal that thunder, but obviously raised a lot of questions.
Right. Well, let's go ahead and guess.
And, okay.
I do not actually have a copy with me of the May.
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Okay. I believe it was in your...
I'm pretty sure it's in our production, but I didn't...
Okay. Well,
can
I'm
we
sure...
get a clean copy?
Yeah, I'll get a clean copy.
No, I mean, yeah. Alyssa should be able...
Yeah, we should have
wanna,
that, Alyssa. Do you need the...
original
production? Do you need the supervisory letter date? Because I think Dina gave you all these. 2007-17. Yeah.
This was even in your list when you sent us your request.
I know.
So why don't you have it?
That's okay.
Oh, let's see. Maybe. No, I don't have it either. Wait. Yeah. So we could probably get this copied.
Yeah,
why don't we just go get this copied?
Okay.
So we have something to...
I want to take a little break.
Yeah. Okay. We're pausing the recording at 11:53.
Sorry.
We are restarting the recording at 11:58 a.m.
And go ahead. Is this now number 21?
This is now document number 21.
Want to identify it from the record?
It's a May 8th, 2007 letter from Scott Waterhouse to both the Mr. Chadley and Mr. Mark Watson in London and New York involving the structured credits derivatives examination.
Mm-hmm. Would you prefer just the story, or do you have questions? If you have questions, start with a question, and then we'll go from there.
He has no problem
having
a long narrative, but why don't you start with a question?
Okay, well, let's start with the conclusions.
Right.
Risk-taking on the ABS correlation desk has increased in the last year.
Yep.
So the ABS correlation desk refers to London?
Correct. That's right.
Management and control oversight are now satisfactory, is also a conclusion.
Yes.
And then you've identified two matters requiring attention, which was formerly had some other name. The ABS correlation desk and the P&L attribution analysis.
Yep.
Why don't you tell me about the ABS correlation desk?
Yeah, that's the... I think whenever we see a business that is expanding considerably, I think we look at it to flag it and try and make sure that they're not going to get back into a situation they did with the traditional, correlation book. Because remember, when we looked at this structured credit business, it included the correlation book, not ABS now.
Right.
The corporate credit correlation book, whereby the improvements that had been made and noted in New York had also been rolled out and improved there. Okay, so let's differentiate. In this report, it's talking about one business but a couple different desks. And maybe in the future we need to go back to that chart. Remember that chart on the credit derivatives where we outlined each trading desk and kind of gave conclusions by them? But clearly, as we're talking about, management and control oversight have significantly improved. Right? You can see that that comment is specifically talking about the credit correlation desk as opposed to the ABS correlation desk. So what we're doing here is we're giving credit to the improvement on the corporate credit correlation desk that is, quite frankly, extremely complex because of all the modeling underlying those exposures. But we're raising, as a matter of requiring attention, the growth and new business on the ABS correlation desk side. So that is where the mortgage product was going. And I think down here, under summary of findings, it reiterates the first paragraph. First paragraph under summary of findings. Trading activities are complex and involve the management of both price and credit risk. Presently, the most significant credit exposure is managed by the ABS correlation desk as it holds a large position in U.S. subprime mortgages with limited liquidity and hedging opportunities. So I think clearly this prompted our putting the MRA in, which basically said risk controls and reporting need upgrading to ensure that they adequately measure and reflect emerging business risks. And I guess from our standpoint, the emerging is clearly this subprime component. And I'm not sure in the first quarter of 2007 whether there was a true appreciation for the contagion that would ultimately hit based on subprime. But it clearly, we were flagging it at that point and saying this is a significant change, it's been ramping up, and let's make sure that recent market events have highlighted new liquidity and basis risk consideration, and management should make sure that it's measuring the risks of its new exposures. Again, here is a balancing act. Would we have considered, price risk or credit risk, worse if it weren't for the improvements we saw on the regular correlation side? I can't answer that question, but we saw it as an emerging risk. And it wasn't, quite frankly, it wasn't far after that that you started seeing things like Bear Stearns and, well, that didn't actually, that happened in 2008, didn't it? Early on,
right.
2008. So, I mean,
well,
you
actually
started
the Bear Stearns,
yeah,
hedge funds was 07.
That's correct. And which then triggered more oversight and OCC, as we all saw things emerging, we all kicked into gear.
So this is probably a question for somebody else, but on this last paragraph.
Yes, go ahead.
On page two,
the second sentence. The most notable improvements have been in desk oversight,
yeah,
analytical capabilities, and
right,
CMAC processes. I mean, how does the comment here square with the earlier concern that the independent risk folks were too close and too involved?
That doesn't at all interrelate between our view of the Capital Markets Approval Committee. I think if you look at the structure of the Capital Markets Approval Committee, it includes really every person around the table that needs to be there. It's front office, it's product control, so middle office, it's back office, so it's operations, and then you have legal compliance. I'm not sure whether audit sits on that. But again, it's all the parties to a potential product that should be saying what they should. I think if you look back at where the CMAQ process was earlier in the decade and where it is today, even this memo that I hadn't seen that you kindly brought to our attention is a thick discussion.
Right.
And historically, they either really didn't have much going through CMAQ or were lacking, you know, substantive discussions of the risks and things like that. So, yes, I think the question is for someone else. I think we need to go back specifically to the EIC of the exam, right, and ask her the question of, you know, what context were you talking about Capital Markets Approval Committee? That's why I really was interested in that memo, and I wanted to see if we got that memo as a part of this exam, because it was entirely relevant. We should have gotten it in the request letter material, and if we got it, we would have reviewed it. And then it would have come up as to, well, were we okay with it or not, and did they sufficiently explain the subprime exposure? There's a variety of questions on that. But again, at the end of the day, I don't know what our conclusion would be, and I'm not going to postulate as far as, right, you know, I think let's wait and see, and we'll go back and do a little homework on that. And
so
if you want to ask
another
question.
The bottom line is you can't really answer
his question. I can't answer his question.
Right. Thank you.
On that, yes.
Okay.
Sorry, I go about things in a
longer
way.
Well, you're thinking through it.
I'm thinking as an examiner. Yes, I am.
You weren't the person responsible
That's
for
correct.
That part of the exam, and so you can't really answer the question.
That is correct.
Yeah, no, your process of leading us through this discussion has been very informative, and I really appreciate it.
I hope so. Okay, but that's that one.
So document 22 is notes on the senior supervisor's meeting. And this is sort of post
yep.
stuff hitting the fan.
Yep. Yes. Yes, it is.
So,
what's the date?
The date of this document is
November. Well,
it's an undated document.
The meeting was as of November 19th, 2007.
Right.
Yeah, this was a big one.
And so it's a meeting among the Federal Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve Board, the OCC, the SEC, the FSA from the UK, the FSA observing from Japan. And as I recall, this may not be completely accurate, is that November 4th, 2007 was sort of the moment when the big shakeup hits Citigroup. They have the management changes because between mid-October of 07 and November 4th of 07, they realize that, in fact, their subprime exposure is much larger than it had previously been reported.
Correct.
And so then heads began to roll.
Right.
Before we sort of get into that document, take me back to October 2007 and sort of where you guys were in the process and how you personally sort of first learned of what would be this catastrophic loss rolling through the books first at Citi and then back onto the Citi Group and then back onto Citibank.
I'll just start this by saying I would need to do that entirely by recollection, all right? If I had known you wanted me to give you kind of my view on pure chronology, you know, I would have gone back to make sure I was prepared to speak to it. But I will tell you, if I remember correctly, and I'm going to state it that, by the time, I mean long before the time they actually disclosed, right, to the market, we knew, you know, there was more subprime exposure there. That's why we geared up to do the examination that we did, right, in December of 2007. And we were tracking, you know, and talking with the bank about what exposure they had and how. I honestly, you know, you're talking about 2007 and the results, things happened pretty quickly.
Right.
And I think even if you look at our risk assessment for like the third quarter, you know, of 2007, we were probably still trying, all of us, to find out on the regulatory community the exact exposure, right? And Scott may have a little better recollection of the interactions with, you know, maybe senior management. But we're all talking about subprime, trying to figure out exactly where the exposure is.
Right.
So by the time they actually went with the disclosure, right, I mean, they pretty much knew what they had.
Right.
Right. Now, our examination that was conducted in the last part of the fourth quarter was geared up very, very quickly because everyone wanted to know what happened and why, right? Including you know, our senior management, and basically, you know, said, get in there and take a look, not only at what happened and why. So that examination as a prelude included two pieces. The governance piece, right, which really looked at communications back and forth with executive management and the board, but also the other piece there, and I think the memo says that, you know, Fred Crumlish did the piece on governance, and it was my responsibility on looking at the CDO exposure and how much there was, and basically, were they valuing it correctly? In other words, you know, was there more losses to come, and were they doing what should be done and not just maybe trying to limit the exposure at that point? So was it a realistic view, or was there other things to do?
Right.
But yes, there was a lot of change and a lot of actions.
So do you recall how you first learned that the liquidity puts were going to be a big problem? Was it someone in the OCC who came to you and said, holy moly, these things are, we thought they were all remote, but it turns out, you know, blah, blah, blah. Was it someone at Citi who came over?
Do you agree with what he just said? I'm not challenging you,
yeah.
But do you agree with what he just said, which is that the liquidity puts were the big problem?
For Citibank? Oh, yeah, they were a big problem for Citibank. Do I remember exactly how I came about it? I will put that on my list and try and figure out exactly how it came about it. But one of the ways we were notified about it was from the bank and corporate treasury, because
the guys who originally put the limit on it.
No, they hadn't put the limit on it. Corporate treasury, at least from the management who was there at the time, told us it was a surprise to them as well. Right? The limit came down on the treasury down inside the CIB. So the local treasury. But when the liquidity puts had to be funded, right, it clearly then was $25 billion went out the door.
Right.
And quite frankly, we comment in the year-end report how funding of certain, you know, contingent liabilities effectively, and management's decision to fund contingent liabilities and consolidate them, basically used up a healthy amount of Citibank's and Citigroup's liquidity. So that was a piece of our knowledge. But I'm going to make a note and go back and try and actually figure out how I first was notified. I mean, like you say, we had a sense, you know, we knew they existed, but I think it was most likely, well, let me find out, okay?
All right. So let's go through this document, and these are sort of, I understand, comments, and you can tell me whether you agree with these comments or not.
First of all, have you ever seen this document before?
I believe I have, yes, and I was actually an attendee at this meeting.
So on page 2... under the what worked well section,
right.
Management believed it had taken effective action to prevent exposure to exotic subprime risks in its consumer bank. The bank essentially abstained from lending in this market and was able to avoid potentially substantial subprime exposures. So that was...
Okay. Now, one comment on that. When they're talking about the consumer bank, right, that does not, I don't know whether the actual consumer bank includes City Financial, right?
Which is not in the bank.
That's correct. But City Financial included, City Financial was basically a, you know, finance company, a lender, you know, and it had mortgages in it.
Right.
I don't know whether that was used or not used by downtown to source any mortgages for some of those, all right, non-agency, all right, non-public residential mortgage-backed securities. But we'll tell you this much. The consumer bank that was under Citibank N.A., for the most part, stayed away from subprime lending.
Right.
And that is a true statement.
Right.
They didn't want to go down that path. And interestingly enough, that, you know, it's our understanding that that's what prompted downtown to source whatever they needed to fill these securities from mortgage brokers.
And by downtown, you mean?
The CDO warehouse.
Right.
And CDO cash desk.
Right.
Okay? Because they were feeding the securities.
Right.
Right? So, but the other thing is, at one point, and they actually did this, and I think Scott has a little bit more information on it, but they actually talked about and went out and acquired this company called Argent.
Yes.
Which was a subprime originator. Argent. Now, the story was that there was some kind of relationship between Citi and Argent already, and basically the acquisition was part of a, you know, some type of negotiated agreement, all right, to take Argent out. But we had heard that downtown wanted their own subprime origination function. And so they went after Argent. Now, they came to us, and Scott knows about this, to basically put Argent under the bank. But the reality is, by the time Argent was actually acquired, the market was dead.
Right.
There was no production coming out of it. They didn't buy any of the loans that Argent generated. And the only thing they took on was a servicing portfolio,
right,
of Argent. So, but it showed the dichotomy, right? It gets back to that culture. The consumer bank, at least the bank's piece of the consumer bank, non-City Financial,
right,
didn't want to go down the subprime road in a big way. So downtown wanted their own. And basically won out in a negotiation with executive management, I presume. So that's that. But I wanted to clarify,
right,
that because there are mortgages in the consumer bank that came in from City Financial that but were not in the National Bank.
Right.
And domestic City Financial, I think, is under the holding company, not the broker-dealer, which would have been under Citigroup. So you can check up with the Fed on that.
Okay.
All right?
So, under the what did not work,
yep,
well, which is much
much longer.
Yeah.
Fourth paragraph down. Senior management, business line, and risk management did not fully appreciate the market risk of the leveraged loan pipeline or the retained super senior CDO positions. Is that reflective of your feelings as well?
No.
No?
Well, define senior management. If you're talking about Tom Harris, all right, I'm sorry, he was a mortgage expert. Now, at the end of the day, we're probably talking nuance here because he would probably say, I would have no idea that subprime could have gotten as bad as it did. And I'm not sure anybody really had a full appreciation for how bad subprime really was. But when you think historically through any number of economic cycles we've had in the United States, in the worst crises, residential mortgages, you know, you've seen some markets that would, you know, go down and tank in a certain ways, but never the extent of what we're dealing with in the residential mortgage market today. again, not an expert on this, but clearly they didn't have an appreciation for
so
that. But Maharis, I'm differentiating, he understood mortgage products.
Right. But maybe someone at the
yes.
Prince level?
Correct. Correct. I think probably. But again, you're running a complex company. Then the question is, should you have known?
Right.
And, you know, leverage loans. I mean, leverage loans, and Scott will talk to you about leverage loans. I know he intends to do that. I mean, they were upping limits on both of these products right into the face of the deterioration of the market. And leverage loans, that's a credit function. And they're, you know, usually you talk about leverage loans, they're more leveraged than other traditional companies, right?
Right.
So they're higher risk to begin with. So.
So the next paragraph then
yes.
says, management found that balance sheet and risk limits were not adequately enforced, and traditional risk metrics for leveraged loans and CDOs did not fully present risks.
What's your
first of all,
yeah,
do, you under, do you understand that? And if you do, can you explain it to me?
No, I don't understand it. Because when you talk about enforcing limits, you talk about if you have limits, did you adhere to them?
Or is there a big exceptions report?
Correct. Or is there an exceptions report? What management did here is double the limits on leveraged loans. So I don't know whether, you know, it wasn't enforced. I think there was, my understanding is, there was probably a discipline that wasn't exercised. I think that's probably, you know, my interpretation of what they would say. And traditional risk metrics for leveraged loans and CDOs did not, and I don't understand that either because
okay.
I don't know that there's a lot of traditional risk metrics for either one of these factors. So I, you know.
All right.
Just a.
But again, this is a document that's just, that's, that is attempting to report what management said. Okay? Management said. This was the question. Management's response was this.
Okay, that's a
this
question.
Is not an examiner's. This,
right.
This is not an examiner's interpretation.
Right. Question one in senior management.
Correct.
Right.
This is Citigroup.
Right.
And this is Bushnell. That's interesting. It doesn't have the bank participants there. Very interesting.
So there were bank participants at this November 19th meeting?
I believe that was the intent of the senior supervisor group to come in. Because this is...
Because it says meeting with firm.
Right.
But I thought...
This is... No. This is like... I was at the meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to go back and ask.
Yeah.
Do we know who created this document, who drafted this document?
I do
not
know.
Do you have any idea? Do you know?
Found it in your files, but don't know.
You know who would know? Make a note, John Fleming. You should know.
Okay, who's John Fleming?
John Fleming's right there. He did a lot of the work on the governance side for Fred Cromish. John would know. Just make a note on your pad, and we'll find out. I believe this was a meeting with the bank, and I believe this is the bank's response.
Yeah, number one, clearly, right? In senior management's opinion.
Yep.
Well, it says the information contained in this report and shared during interagency discussions and discussions with the firms.
Must be treated as confidential.
Yeah, so I couldn't tell from looking at the document whether you agency folks were talking amongst yourself about what the bank folks had told you, or whether there was actually a meeting with the banks on that day. But presumably we'll figure that out.
We need to get you an answer. Yep.
So going on to page 3.
Oh, okay. Want to stay on this, or do you want us to go back and clarify what it is? All right, you want to stay?
I'll just hit a few high points.
Okay.
Basic question is, do you understand what it says? Can you explain it to me, and do you agree with it or not? So under item 4 on page 3, first sentence, key risk reports did not effectively communicate the magnitude and degree of the potential risk to the company for CDOs and structured credit trading. Do you understand what they mean by key risk reports, and do you agree with its assessment that whatever
presumption is that key risk reports would be reports that go to either executive management or the board, right? And that would kind of, to me, be key risk report.
Right.
And I think one of the things we've summarily, criticized and have raised is their inability to aggregate, right, information across the company clearly. And I think I think MIS on, the risks in the company was problematic. So I would agree with that statement.
So the next two sentences, the nature, origin, and size of CDO exposure were surprising to many in senior management and the board. The liquidity put exposure was not well known. So as I read that, it basically says the board of directors and at least Chuck Prince, I'm not sure who else is included in senior management,
right,
didn't really comprehend the liquidity put exposure and didn't really understand the size of the CEO exposure, CEOs being ABS subprime linked CEOs.
Yep. I think, again, if you look through our report and the weaknesses, all right, in reporting clearly, the reports to the board in our, in our supervisory letter were clearly deficient. And again, I'm not specifically, talking about this particular document, because, again, I would like to know exactly I think this was a compilation of interview of management, but I'm not certain. So I'd like to know where it came from and who put it together.
Okay. Senior management oversight, page 5, is this section.
Yep.
And then on to page 6, the top of page 6.
Okay.
It says super senior AAA CDO tranches. An acknowledgement of the risk in its super senior AAA CDO exposure was perhaps Citigroup's, quote, biggest miss, close quote. And again, this is, I guess, part of senior management's reply. You concur with that finding that was probably Citigroup's biggest miss, whatever that.
You know what? I think you'd have to ask the EIC question.
Okay. Fair enough.
All right. Because if you think about the losses, right? Early in the phase, they hit the world that I was responsible for.
Right.
And that's natural. You had off-balance sheet vehicles. You had trading instruments. Mark to market. Everything bubbled up. Investors didn't want to touch it. Contagion hit everything. Now we're in the traditional credit cycle. And losses that are being sustained by banks across the board, not only subprime, but, credit card are just, and residential mortgages, not only subprime, but I'm guessing prime and home equity losses are and exposures are big. So at the end of the day, I think when this report was put together, clearly the biggest miss was, and again, it gets back to, I don't want to answer the question, and it's not that I'm trying to avoid the question, it's just the biggest miss to who? You got to think right. about the board or senior management being Chuck Prince. But if you broaden senior management, a case could be made that a guy like Maharis and a guy like Bushnell were senior management.
Right.
Because Maharis, at the end of the day, you know, was a co-head of the CIB, and Bushnell was the chief risk officer of the company. So I, you know, there's a lot of different ways to answer it. It was a miss, I think, from their standpoint. Biggest, I think.
It was big. Someone else was called who had their hands on all
it. Was big. Interestingly enough, as you go back and if you looked at the disclosures on the super senior, the stuff that was in the liquidity puts had older vintages. Like they started doing those liquidity puts years ago.
Right.
So some of the mortgage exposure was longer dated. And I think not as bad as some of the recent stuff, that the losses that were taken and what was left over in maybe the CDO warehouse and some of the financing or the ABS desk, which took some heavier losses, right? Because super seniors, the losses in it, I mean, it was a big number and it hits everyone on the side of the head. $25 billion is a huge number. But the losses in that were not as... per, you know, pennies per dollar were not as huge as some of the other things that were charged off almost in their entirety.
Right.
So you know, I'm not trying to defend anything here. It's all variants of bad.
Right.
Right.
Okay, on to document number 23 then.
Okay.
This document for the record is a memo from you and Michael Sullivan.
Yes.
To John Lyons, dated January 17, 2008, subprime CDO valuation and oversight review. So this is the memo reflecting the exam you discussed.
Correct.
Previously.
That's right. Where, you know, and that memo, that's the conclusion memo that basically was behind this communication.
The supervisory
letter. Supervisory letter, 2008-5. That was issued, it may be, here it is, next on your list. This was issued February 14th, 2008.
Right.
This is the exam that includes the two components. The governance component, that I think even up in the name, he says, Fred, see? Fred Crime. All right? And me. And this memo from Michael, all right, is basically the support for what made it into this memo near the end, underlying the CDOs. Did you get all of that?
Yeah, I'm just looking. We've got some stapling issues here. There are several things.
Oh, got lumped together and stapled together. Oh, there you go.
Maybe we should, after you get it straightened out, then you should go back through what you just said. But let's,
right. But so anyway, let's stick to document 23, and then we'll get on to the ladder. So 23 is the memorandum putting together the evaluation of the ABS CDOs when the stuff hit the fan in fourth quarter of 2007.
Correct.
So, explain to me the sort of differences between the statements in the previous exam report about the effectiveness of the CMAC process, and you thought management had been listening to you. Where here is the sort of indication that, in fact, no, they hadn't been listening to you? What are the most significant parts of this that say, instead of doing what we thought they were doing, they were off doing something else?
Something else. I think as you look at the, well, I don't think that was a purpose of this conclusion memo.
Okay,
all right?
Fair enough.
I think the conclusion memo was to say what is the, you know, what are the problems, right? Basically, how these problems arose, all right? And interestingly enough, more of the thing was get a sense of what are the exposures out there, nail down exactly, you know, determine if the exposures are the same as the disclosures that they were, and then make sure that they're adequately valued. That was the piece on this side of the equation. Now, you know, I don't think it was an attempt to go back and compare and contrast.
Okay.
I think it was a, what is the current state? All right, so I think as you can see, Michael's, let's go through, and I don't have this document in front of me.
Let me ask you, did you participate in providing information for any part of this memo, which you've marked as number 23? Did you have any input for any of this information?
Define if I had input.
Well, some of the memos we've looked at previously, you went right to a section, so that was my section.
Yeah, but this is all my section.
Oh. All right?
All right? This came up from the review, again, that I did not personally participate on. Yeah, but Mike Sullivan led it, and basically this memo is a compilation of the findings of that. So I reviewed it. All right, clearly, and Mike and I had a lot of dialogue back and forth, and I tried to give you folks that the extent of that dialogue back and forth. But I do want to follow up on that one, you know, CMAQ document,
right?
That, you know, I personally was not aware of, but our other examiners or Mike might have been aware of. To me, that's, you know, that would have a say in whether CMAQ completely failed. Because it was our understanding in discussions with management that subprime, right, as far as CDOs went, didn't go through CMAQ, right? When we were conducting this review, we asked questions, or at least I asked questions of the examiners, and it was their belief that subprime didn't come up. That's why I'm saying I need to go back to that CMAQ document. And it's possible that, you know, the people conducting this review didn't see that because I didn't see it myself. All right? So I don't want to sit into a mode of compare and contrast.
Okay.
I think our view was, you know, first we look at the valuation. And I think our sense was and our conclusion was that the valuation at the time was within the parameters, within kind of the standards that people were doing on the industry. It was some basic modeling. It was a okay attempt at coming up with a value at the time. And they subsequently, like, improved the quality of their valuations, you know, over a period of time, because Mike came back in within 6 months to look at the improvements they made to their model. We were highly critical of even the control environment that this model was in, because it wasn't really controlled, and we were critical on the model validation. And ultimately, the models on this valuation never were really able to be validated, and the reason is there was no market, no traded market, no way to independently go out and source prices. So we were glad when we kind of pushed management recently to take that up to the board and tell them that there were some reasons why certain models couldn't be validated. But I think we walked away saying the valuation was okay at the current time, but they needed to improve it going right forward.
Now, did you guys ever kick the tires over at market? Or did the FSA or the Fed ever sort of like poke around over there and
see
what their real process was?
I don't know. I think that would probably be a great question for the FSA.
Right.
You know, them being in that venue. I don't know if the Fed did it either.
Okay.
But I think, you know, most were trying to use basic DCF models, you know, and discount based on, you know, whatever they could find was relevant. But, I mean, some of the blunt tool things that they were using, at least initially, some HPA numbers that were more national.
So and by, started, let me slow yes. down a bit. By DCF, you mean
discounted cash flow.
And by HPA, you mean
house price appreciation. Forecasts and numbers okay. that are reported. Yes.
Yep.
All right. So no, fine. I'm glad you slowed me down. But the reality is, I think as they tried to get better, they tried to find better proxies, if you will. Like
right.
they tried to break HPA down into more regions and as close as they could as they fine tuned the model. I mean, that being said, it's still a model and it's still, you know, not validated because nothing's being traded.
Right.
But again, we believe, you know, clearly, you know, control groups need to be more engaged and fully execute their responsibilities. Product control, which is the independent pricing group and reports up through finance in Citi, at the time we felt needed more quantitative resources. Quite frankly, in this environment with the complexity of products, you know, it's one thing if you're looking at FX or vanilla options or that type of thing, you can go externally and source data.
Right.
You can use market for certain things. But then all of a sudden you're starting to need to price using models and or interpolation. And you could just see a reliance on the front office. So we raised that as needing to be, you know, resolved, and they needed to get some quantitative resources, and which they did. And let's see, I don't want to go through this whole thing.
Okay, let me just
yeah.
pick
go
out
ahead and pick
so
out a few things that
page,
you thought were
page 3.
Yep,
the second paragraph under B.
Yep,
the underlined sentence: the board and senior management need to ensure that independent risk management has complete authority and/or executes its authority to restrain the business when appropriate.
Yep.
Close quote. So, explain to me if this is directed to Mr. Bushnell and his group, and if so, was it your view that rather than restraining risk exposure and limits, that every time they bumped up against the boundary, they simply increased the boundary and allowed the
that's correct
Citigroup to
just look at
risk.
The lack of discipline on the limits, all right, leveraged loans as well as, you know, CDOs, and again, this was probably the culmination of some of the thinking we had over time that risk wasn't purely independent. And I think, you know, if risk had been independent, A, they would have been measuring things in the proper way, all right, up through senior management and the board. And B, if they thought, you know, too much risk was being taken, they should have stood their guard and drawn the line. And I think the fact that risk limits were just, you know, doubled in certain things, and it just kind of said, we got to a culmination and said, we believe risk management was not there to question and curtail the business, but was there to just facilitate. And we called it. Of course, it took a significant events to make the call. But again, it resulted in some changes, right?
Right.
And I think at the end of the day, you know, we'll see. We think they should work. Go ahead.
On to page 4.
Yep.
Second full sentence of that page, quote, limiting super senior exposure in synthetic form
yes.
should have been done similarly to limits in cash instruments,
yes.
close quote.
And I believe as we put this document together, there was the view that there were no super senior limits for the sentence before it, right? Kind of indicates that there was a limit from Treasury with regard to the liquidity puts, right? And that was the $25 billion we've talked about before.
So so the liquidity puts are part of the U.S. cash CDO
yes.
business?
Okay. Well, see, it was the U.S. cash CDO business that... Now, hang on. Let me do this one last time.
Okay.
Right? The U.S. cash CDO business generated the product that went into these off-balance sheet
right.
special purpose vehicles that
right.
were managed externally.
Right.
The liquidity puts were actually in the bank trading account, right? And that was the New York trading account. What we're differentiating here is the super senior limits didn't have, or
but
there were no limits for the ABS correlation desk in London
right.
for their super senior exposures as there were for, we say the U.S. cash CDO business, but we're referring to the liquidity puts. Or we may be referring to there was residual subprime exposure in the U.S. cash CDO business.
Right.
Outside of the liquidity puts, we may be referring to that, but I'd have to double check with Michael.
Okay.
All right.
And that actually raises another question I had about the cash
yes.
CDO exposure originated out of New York
right.
that was on the books at the end. Not having sort of seen any internal documents on the trail, the question I had when I'm looking at it is,
right.
was that an intentional choice by Citigroup to put those on their books, or was it a case of the music stopping and them being caught with an inventory that they were trying to sell, and then the music stopped, and it's like,
That was in the CDO book. There was some music stopping because that's what warehouses do.
Right.
They basically fill up, and it takes them some time to generate product. And some of that exposure was either basically in the warehouse outside of our purview.
Right.
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 That was the music stopped, and they couldn't generate and push it out anymore. And some was due to the fact of just retaining super senior exposure.
So if we go on to page 5, under chronology of positions, it says
yep.
the bank built up super senior positions because they are hard to sell in the primary issuance market at the nominal spreads available for super senior once deals were completed,
mm-hmm.
10 to 20 bips, and the bank was reluctant to give up some of the inception profits. There is virtually no secondary market. Close quote. So that's referring to, at this point in time, how things had changed.
Changed. How the market had changed substantially. Right. Now, we had a number of discussions with, at the time, some of the people during this exam and some of the traders who were, you know, basically, again, the ones who weren't involved in creating the exposures were basically like, why would you do that? Why would you create something that you'd only earn 20 basis points on at a maximum, but you'd have all this downside exposure? But the other thought is that if at the front of the deal you put together these assets and then sold everything out, right, you basically, you know, it's common that you get fees for structuring these things up front.
Right.
Right? Which, of course, gets back to the earnings issue. If you sell and not retain the super senior, you know, there aren't many investors out there that really wanted super senior exposure.
Right.
So unless you are able to sweeten the pot or make the yield a little higher than the original deal was priced at, you probably weren't going to sell them anyway. So, you know, the question we had is, would that have made these whole structures, some of these structures, you know, uneconomic to begin with?
Well, who was paying the fee to structure it if they couldn't sell it?
No, the ones that were sold. We're talking about when the deal was actually done, and that when things were still good, all right, when things were still good, the bank would basically get a fee for some of the things that it could have done, and it would basically have to basically give up some of those inception profits were it to fully sell off or hedge some of that super senior exposure.
So on to page 6.
Yep.
The last principal full paragraph that starts
this one?
By late 2006. Performance of 06 vintages were being reported as markedly worse than earlier vintages, a warning signal that led some market participants to reevaluate their strategies and pull back from the ABS market. The U.S. Cash, CDO, and ABS correlation desk did not pause, and they saw this as an incentive to do more deals given the wider spreads. CDO issuance in 2006 was double the amount in 2005, and 2007 was planned to continue the increase.
Yeah, they accelerated into a difficult market. Classic case. I just, you know, again, it is what it is, unfortunately. I think, again, some others in industry, and I think, you know, Michael might have some perspective on this too. Some others, because I think he might have actually been out to some of the other companies as well. Some of the others pulled back, you know, when they saw that deals were, you know, possibly not as economic as they could have been. And that wasn't the case at Citi. They kept doing deals.
So would it there have been some sort of decision memo, or how do you think that the decision was reflected or executed at Citi? To, I mean, where when we go to talk to our friends at the Fed,
right.
I mean, what are we looking for?
good question.
I mean, presumably if you say, hey, let's double our CDO exposure, that's not something two guys in the ops trading desk do. Presumably, that has to be something fairly high up.
I would, the food chain. I agree with you. Presumably, I would suspect that it would have had to be at the Maharis level. Certainly, if you want to go further into the specific modeling issues, we need to call in Michael. All right?
My ability to understand things beyond my first year of calculus in college is rather limited at this point.
Well, that's why they're PhDs, right? But again, this what was really intended to be a pretty good, you know, write-up and give you some background and stuff like that, got captured into this supervisory letter.
Right.
All right.
So page 11,
yep.
then,
right.
Under the paragraph titled August 2007.
Okay. Oh, right.
Severe market disruption spreads to CP market, and to avoid liquidity put exercise, the bank steps in and starts buying the paper onto its balance sheet. So this is when the mutual funds of the world said, hey, we don't want this stuff.
Yeah, actually, I think I go back to you on that, but yeah, this is when. This is when. And this is when basically those mutual funds basically said, you're, you know, Citibank NA, here's the liquidity put provider. You know, you're the liquidity put provider. You take my place, basically,
right,
in funding the CP to fund these special purpose vehicles.
So at some point in August 07, when we go into the Citigroup, Citibank records, we should find a decision being made, presumably at the highest levels,
to fund and
purchase the paper.
Correct.
Okay, that's it for document 23. Now for document 24, which you'll have to sort of unstable what's been stable.
That's fine. Yeah, and make sure you have all of it. I believe there's 7 pages.
Right.
Okay.
Document 24 is the letter you've already referenced a couple times, dated February 14th, 2008, to Vikram Pandit, the new CEO at Citigroup.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the examinations,
right,
and lists the new matters requiring attention. And
yes.
Number one on the hit parade is corporate governance and risk management.
That's correct. Now, just to make sure again so that you understand, that was the piece that was done by Fred Crumlish.
Right.
All right. And reported up to, I believe in this case, it was John Lyons who signed the letter.
Okay.
Right. And John, you're speaking with tomorrow.
Right.
All right.
So is there a reason, and I guess I should ask him, that it went to, was Vikram only at Citigroup? He was not at Citibank? Is that why the OCC was?
I don't believe, yes, that is the correct answer. Vikram was an officer of Citigroup, right, and not specifically, right, I believe, an officer of Citibank N.A. at the time. And that was not uncommon. Every corporate officer of Citigroup is not also necessarily corporate officers of Citibank N.A. or all the other legal vehicles. So you get back to this, you know, difficulty of evaluating management that may or may not be part of the part of your institution that you're responsible to supervise.
Right. So then on to page four.
Yes.
Strengthen business oversight controls in capital markets and banking group. This
right.
then would
this
be
was
your
this
thing.
This is the piece. Sub italics two is coming directly from the memo we just spoke about.
Right.
All right. Now here, in this first sentence, just to bring your attention, I think that that will be clearly the story, right? And obviously they'll stick to it. And as looking back on the whole situation, I think rating agency ratings on some of these structured transactions was not what anyone expected to be compared to rating agencies on a typical corporate credit.
Right.
Right?
Right.
A lot of
AAA CDO, it's not a AAA
corporate entity. You know, and just the ability to analyze. So what they were doing is they were putting comfort in the levels of subordination to render their ratings on the high quality stuff. Well, again, no one ever believed that you'd blow through maybe up to anywhere between 12 and 30% subordination of losses to get to a super senior position. But
so in the middle of the second paragraph,
yes,
it says, while the desk level market risk management staff seem to appropriately
yes.
escalate issues, decisions
yes.
on risk were routinely deferred to the senior business unit management's wishes.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe there's a gentleman by the name of Murray
Barnes.
Would that be,
just, yes.
be someone who is at the desk level?
Risk management.
Yes.
Yes. Murray so, just left Citi, by the way.
I believe he's going
hired.
To for Barclays.
Yes, he is. Barcap. We worked with Murray very closely through this crisis. You know, Murray was one of the first ones to start, you know, raising concerns. But our belief north of him, you know, risk management was more there to facilitate the business.
Right. So did he report to
B.B. Duke to Dave Bushnell?
Okay.
All right? Yep.
So Murray seemed to bring up the issue, but when it got to Bushnell's level, as I understand it, Bushnell would talk to Maharis and say, what do you need?
B.B. or Bushnell.
Okay.
Now, you know, it's like Phoebe may not bring up an issue to Bushnell just because she knows Bushnell might not do anything with it.
Right.
Although she's probably smart enough to have brought the issue up anyway and have some trail of issue along the way. But yeah, I think our view is, and it's clearly illuminated, that after everything we had saw and after what happened here, but at the end of the day, risk management should have been doing what they should have been doing. But management was the one that accelerated in the face of a crisis. And why did they do that? And under whose authorization did they do it? Did it stop at Maharis or did it go all the way up? Was
right.
the corporate pressure so much for earnings that it drove people to take undue risk?
And then over on page 5, the last paragraph
before
strengthened CDO valuation process, the second sentence is, I believe, a topic you've already raised. However, the decision to actively utilize subprime collateral should have been reviewed and evaluated by the CMAC and the BPC.
Yes.
Now that's the issue you're going to
That's the issue I'm going to go back to, because it seems clear that there was a discussion of subprime in that CMAC package, right? Which was different from what we understood when we were talking to the people that we talked to during that examination,
right?
Who thought it hadn't gone. Although no one was there pretty much at that time that had been before.
It's they were same ship, but different captain.
Bingo.
Right.
Bingo. Well, fortunately, you know, they got left the ship, right?
Right.
Whatever was still sailing, something like that.
Okay. John Lyons.
Yep. Report.
So this is the April 9th, 2008 report as of December 31st, 2007.
Is that on the back of this?
Yeah, you have to tear it apart. Yeah. There's something in the middle I'm not going to use here. It's a John Line thing on CRA. So the staple documents I handed you, 24 refers to the Beekman Pandit letter. There's some stuff in the material I'm not going to utilize today. And then 25 is the 2008 exam report.
The April?
Yeah, as of December 31, 2007, okay. Transmitted.
It's front and back.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm not a big fan of.
Is this part
no,
of
no.
the ROE or
no? The recommendations is yeah. That's extraneous.
Okay, so that's not
extraneous to this interview.
Oh, okay. All right. So, and the cover letter is samples. Okay. And that's number 25.
That's right. The 25th and final.
Great.
Document. So, in essence, this is basically the final version of the letter to Mr. Pandit.
Correct.
And this is where Citibank's composite ratings gets lowered to a 3.
Yep.
Now,
from my standpoint, the principal rating that, well, other than liquidity, which is mine, but you see the sensitivity to market risk?
Yes.
All right. That's pretty much where we would flow up any trading or price risk issues, sensitivity to market risk. Because that's basically includes traded portfolios as well as interest rate risk. So that's where we blended in the conclusion on CDO's exposure.
And so for your piece, liquidity and sensitivity to market risk, tell me how that process works with an institution as large as this. Do you sit down with the EIC and a team of folks and you go, just walk me through?
What we do is each of our teams gather our information and come up with an evaluation of what we think the risk assessment is and what we think the CAMEL should be, We basically discuss it thoroughly. I have team members that basically draft something up for my review. I sit there and I evaluate what they've written and why. I basically edit it and then provide my thoughts and ideas to the EIC. And the EIC has the right and authority to modify and whatever to basically arrive at the final conclusion of the CAMLA. Of course, from his standpoint, he then sends it to the deputy controller,
right,
who obviously also usually signs the cover letter,
right,
with the examiner in charge.
Right.
So that's basically how it happens. It starts at the respective team, all right, my capital markets team, all right, and basically works its way up to the EIC. So, you know, the EIC is ultimately responsible for everything that's in the report. But he would obviously look to us because we've made the recommendation, all right, and he'll either support it or go a different route.
Right. So on sensitivity to market,
yes,
risk,
yep,
do you have a recollection about whether or not the final ratings reflected your recommendation or whether
they did?
They did.
They,
so that was,
they're consistent. Yep. There was no differing in the ranks. The views the views were the same.
Okay.
So you should, yeah.
So page 11.
Yeah, let's see that one. Yep.
It says first primary sentence, second,
yeah,
primary sentence. The primary reasons for this rating are the significant risk exposure in subprime CDO securities that triggered nearly $20 billion,
yeah,
in corporate trading losses to date, as well as deficient risk management practices surrounding the oversight and control of this risk. So, close quote.
Yeah.
So, with respect to the market risk rating, then,
yes,
what was the phrase? The big miss? So, with respect to market risk, then, it's the big miss in that it moved the rating.
Yeah. It moved the rating. That's correct. And our risk assessment, which is done at the same time, was high, and the assessment of management was weak. So obviously, you know, the things, it moved not only our risk assessment, but our sensitivity rating as well. And it was more important in the dial, because you'll see some other things written here on foreign currency translation risk and interest rate risk that all sum up to the sensitivity rating, but the price risk weaknesses and losses were extreme to us and basically warranted downgrading the bank's rating to a 3.
Scott, do you have anything you want to add? To, is there anything I've left out?
I think we're all right.
Now, I know you could add more. I know you well enough. After,
yeah,
how many several hours?
Yes, it has been several hours.
And I really do appreciate,
yeah,
your time and,
right,
your commitment to making this a worthwhile process. But so, in going through what we've gone through, is there something we've missed that we need to go back? Is there something I didn't bring up within your area,
right,
within the capital markets area, that it's like, hey, Bart, you know,
yeah,
nice work on XYZ.
Right.
Or, frankly, ABC is where you need to go look.
Right. Well, no.
With respect to the big question of global...
Well, no, just his capital markets, just Citibank.
I think one of the things, and this is an observation, that created the contagion was the fact that a lot of this risk appeared to be disintermediated, as I said before, all right? But what was happening is, in past cycles, which I referred to before, the exposure remained in the banks, and it could be understood. These products had been sold, you know, created via cash, sold to thousands of different entities, not only in the U.S., but globally.
Right.
Both cash, synthetic, some insurance companies, who knows, banks, hedge funds, you know, all different types of investors. And they were created under, you know, structured product or structured vehicles. So that, I think the reality was, when the analysts and when the whole community started saying, okay, how deep is this hole? The answer wasn't easy for anyone. It wasn't, hey, this is contained, you know, in the banks. We'll figure this out. All we need to do is gather the regulators around. This one could not. It was so opaque that it left everyone questioning, including rating agencies, including, you know, heck, including sovereigns and everyone, as far as where is the exposure, where does it stop? And I think that's probably what exacerbated this cycle, as opposed to all the previous cycles that I've seen. You know, but I think, you know, the regulatory side is one thing. I think the mortgage brokers is something that has to be dealt with. Because, I mean, in one bit of a positive story, you had a bank that was only part of a larger entity say, hey, we don't like this. But somewhere along the line, senior management overruled them and said, well, let's source this stuff from the street. The hard part is, at the end of the day, investors over a long period of time of low rates wanted more yield. They wanted higher yields, and they were looking for ways to do it. And it got done.
And there is no such thing as a free lunch.
Well, that, yeah. Certainly the financial community found that out, right? Certainly. So I think, you know, from your committee side, you know, the banks are one thing, and I hope from our interview you've gotten a sense that we've tried to, you know, attack and engage and deal with issues, right? Certainly there are areas where we could have done better, right? But you've got to figure out a way, A, to get supervisory oversight, at least allow people to look wherever they want in a company under, you know, under the rugs and whatever, because bankers can be pretty good at finding the way of, you know, moving things around to get out from under regulatory oversight. And the other thing is, the pipes coming in. Unless, you know, something was done with subprime mortgage brokers.
Right.
You can regulate the banks to death, and you can basically put them under tight constraints, but if this other pipe is still generating product and how much fraud was in there is still yet to be seen, I believe. You're going to see that over time. You got to deal with the pipes, all the pipes, or else, you know, the problem's not going to get resolved. But I think, you know, again, we've tried to give a picture. I think, you know, looking at all the agencies' responsibility is the right thing to do, and I think you're charged with a good goal to try and find out, you know, how to prevent this in the future. Unfortunately, each crisis comes at us in a different way, doesn't it?
I've heard never again a couple times in my career now.
Never again in this manner, right?
Right.
Never again in this manner.
Right. Well it's 1:15, and I want to thank you for your cooperation.
My pleasure.
Yep. Interview's concluded.